Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, November 15th, 2021. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening live over our radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, you can go to nationallibertyalliance.org and click on our weekly call for instructions to join us by phone, app, or browser. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, it's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save our republic. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. Okay, tonight we're going to pick up where we left off last week in our scripture reading. We're in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 10, and we'll be reading chapter 10 by Alexander Scorby. Luke, chapter 10.
Chapter 10. After these things, the Lord appointed other 70 also, and sent them two and two before his face into every city and place whither he himself would come. Therefore said he unto them, The harvest truly is great, but the laborers are few. Pray ye therefore the Lord of the harvest that he would send forth laborers into his harvest. Go your ways. Behold, I send you forth as lambs among wolves. Carry neither purse nor scrip, nor shoes, and salute no man by the way. And into whatsoever house ye enter, first say, Peace be to this house. And if the Son of Peace be there, your peace shall rest upon it. If not, it shall turn to you again. And in the same house remain, eating and drinking such things as they give, for the laborer is worthy of his hire. Go not from house to house. And into whatsoever city ye enter, and they receive you, eat such things as are set before you, and heal the sick that are therein, and say unto them, The kingdom of God is come nigh unto you. But into whatsoever city ye enter, and they receive you not, go your ways out into the streets of the same, and say, Even the very dust of your city which cleaveth on us we do wipe off against you. Notwithstanding, be ye sure of this, that the kingdom of God is come nigh unto you. But I say unto you, that it shall be more tolerable in that day for Sodom than for that city. Woe unto thee, Chorazin! Woe unto thee, Bethsaida! For if the mighty works had been done in Tyre and Sidon, which have been done in you, they had a great while ago repented, sitting in sackcloth and ashes. But it shall be more tolerable for Tyre and Sidon at the judgment than for you. And thou, Capernaum, which art exalted to heaven, shalt be thrust down to hell. He that heareth you, heareth me. And he that despiseth you, despiseth me. And he that despiseth me, despiseth him that sent me. And the 70 returned again with joy, saying, Lord, even the devils are subject unto us through thy name. And he said unto them, I beheld Satan as lightning fall from heaven. Behold, I give unto you power to tread on serpents and scorpions, and over all the power of the enemy, and nothing shall by any means hurt you. Notwithstanding, in this rejoice not, that the spirits are subject unto you, but rather rejoice, because your names are written in heaven. In that hour Jesus rejoiced in spirit and said, I thank thee, O Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that thou hast hid these things from the wise and prudent, and hast revealed them unto babes. Even so, Father, for so it seemed good in thy sight. All things are delivered to me of my Father, and no man knoweth who the Son is but the Father, and who the Father is but the Son, and he to whom the Son will reveal him. And he turned him unto his disciples, and said privately, Blessed are the eyes which see the things that ye see. For I tell you that many prophets and kings have desired to see those things which ye see, and have not seen them, and to hear those things which ye hear, and have not heard them. And behold, a certain lawyer stood up and tempted him, saying, Master, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? He said unto him, What is written in the law? How readest thou? And he answering said, Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thy strength, and with all thy mind, and thy neighbor as thyself. And he said unto him, Thou hast answered right. This do, and thou shalt live. But he, willing to justify himself, said unto Jesus, And who is my neighbor? And Jesus answering said, A certain man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and fell among thieves, which stripped him of his raiment, and wounded him, and departed, leaving him half dead. And by chance there came down a certain priest that way, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. And likewise a Levite, when he was at the place, came and looked on him, and passed by on the other side. But a certain Samaritan, as he journeyed, came where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion on him, and went to him, and bound up his wounds, pouring in oil and wine, and set him on his own beast, and brought him to an inn, and took care of him. And on the morrow, when he departed, he took out 2 pence, and gave them to the host, and said unto him, Take care of him, and whatsoever thou spendest more, when I come again, I will repay thee. Which now of these three, thinkest thou, was neighbor unto him that fell among the thieves? And he said, He that showed mercy on him. Then said Jesus unto him, Go, and do thou likewise. Now it came to pass, as they went, that he entered into a certain village, and a certain woman named Martha received him into her house. And she had a sister called Mary, which also sat at Jesus' feet and heard his word. But Martha was cumbered about much serving, and came to him and said, Lord, dost thou not care that my sister hath left me to serve alone? Bid her therefore that she help me. And Jesus answered and said unto her, Martha, Martha, thou art careful and troubled about many things, but one thing is needful, and Mary hath chosen that good part which shall not be taken away from her.
Okay. I don't see Jan here. Is Terry here?
Terry,
you're here. Okay. Jan is here also? I'm here.
Yes.
Oh. Okay. All right. Any questions or any announcements to be made?
Yeah, I have a question that comes up periodically. I think maybe it's new listeners checking in or people that don't listen to the call very often. If you're ready, we can run through it. It won't take long.
Okay.
It has a little background here. I'll read that. A friend of mine talks about changing the status pertaining to citizenship. He broke it down to me, the difference of U.S. citizen and state citizen. A U.S. citizen being part for the corporation and state citizen under the protection of the UCC 1-308. Uniform Commercial Codes breaking is entirely away from the United States corporation. I hope I'm explaining this right. Do you have any insight or more information about this? I found books from NLA pertaining to the UCC, and there's an actual book on uniform commercial codes. My questions are, what's the purpose and reason behind the UCC 1-308 as to being actual sovereign citizens to the Republic? Do we have to classify ourselves in a particular way to actually notarize ourselves as status, our status as citizens?
Well, you know, first of all, the word citizen is used some 7 times in the Constitution. So our founding fathers had no problem using that word. Just because that word is, you know, look at the enemy does is they rob the words, change their meaning, and try to make it mean something else. But nothing changed the truth. And they don't have the power, the authority to change the truth. And we did give the United States through the Constitution, I'm pretty sure, I'll have to go look it up, I know I read this in there, the authority to write the process for citizenship, to codify it. There is a process. When a person comes into this country, into this nation, and they become a citizen of the United States, which means they're citizens of all states, not of the federal government, but of the United States. So the point is that you are or acknowledged as a citizen in any state. As you drive from state to one state through another state into another state, you have all the rights and everything and the protection in one state going to another state. And if you're a citizen of New York, for instance, and tomorrow you decide to move to New Jersey, you don't have to report anywhere. You don't have to do anything. You just cross the line and you say, I'm a citizen of New Jersey. But anyone that is a foreigner, anyone that is not born here, natural born or even born, they are not a citizen of the nation or the states, the United States, until they go through the process. So I know I was taught the same thing by a lot of people who spoke about this, and you got to go back, and they suggest to you give up your license, to give up your birth certificate, your Social Security card, you make a proclamation, and you file a declaration with, probably in the county clerk. I know that's where we did it, in the county. And again, it's only a process, really, that is separating us. And it's really flagging us at the same time. It doesn't change anything. You know, we are sovereign people of the United States, and that's that. There's nothing else to talk about. And again, using the word citizen, I would be a little careful in courts to use the word citizen. I don't find a reason to use it in the court because it could be problematic because of the meaning of things. But nevertheless, you know, the court system is going to do whatever they want to do because they're totally out of control. There's no justice in our courts. At least I haven't found it. I'm sure maybe somewhere there's some justice, but far and in between, and that's a fact. I've been into too many courts to realize that they all are on the same page. They're all true believers, too. I have met and talked with many, many lawyers over the years. And they all believe that the common law has been abrogated, and they all believe that somehow there was some authority in that. I mean, look at, we the people ordained and established this Constitution. We received our the unalienable right to have a government by consent, and the blessings of liberty, which started off in the Declaration of Independence, which is a covenant with God. And we're under God's law, and He has blessed this nation, and we have been blessed with many liberties. Unfortunately, of course, the powers that be, prince and power of the air, they have taken control and have brought us into subjection to them. They've put us into situations where we find that we can't continue. Unless we become part of that system, for instance, like having a driver's license. I choose to have a driver's license. I don't feel like going to jail every time I go out and drive in my car. Too many things to do. So I pay their fee. I give them their $60, $80, whatever it is. I don't even remember. But in any event, in my mind, I think, because I have driven commercially in the past, and it's good to have a driver's license in case I decide to drive commercially, because that's what it's for. It's also a good identification. And it seems that, again, they put us in a box. You're not going to be able to open up a bank account and do many things without, a picture ID. And generally speaking, a driver's license or a state ID is what people generally require. You can't even get a notary done without it. But anyway, look at, let them not rob the meaning of the words. Let's use the words for what they are. Let's look at Black's Law and Bouvier's, find the meanings of things. Let's look at our founding fathers and the words of other patriots and those who have been in the judicial system and the Supreme Court years have gone by that have made proper decisions, and let us utilize that. Again, all they're doing is making us chase our tail, so to speak, and also at the same time, they're really controlling us by putting us into that kind of a situation. There's no reason for it. But again, it is kind of a safe thing when you're in court if you want to refer to yourself as something. One of the people is a good thing to refer yourself as. At least I do that. But again, there's a lot of other things that really kind of bring you into a crazy situation when you start to go down that road. I mean, I knew somebody who did all this stuff, and they don't drive. They have to have someone else driving them around wherever they go. And I think that's kind of crazy, and it's also, you know, also to some degree there's a problem with that, I think, on many levels. But let's use our common sense. I think the thing we need to do is take this nation back and correct it, and we can do that by getting involved in the beginning, if it's not already started, a committee of safety, and build a membership within our county. We need about, I've worked out an estimate of about 200 people in every county to perform all the duties necessary that we, the people, must perform. If we want to have government by consent, if we want to exercise our liberties, because right now we don't have government by consent, and it's difficult in many times to exercise our liberties. Look at that individual that has been arrested and is going through court, and he was only defending himself. Yeah, he exercised his Second Amendment in order to preserve his own life. And yet, this out-of-control court system, judicial system, is really prosecuting this individual evilly. But, you know, if you look at what's going on, you've got to remember, we have government not by majority. We have government by the majority that participates. And it works out from looking at the committee man, the statutory committee man process. From looking at that, it takes them about an average, I would say, of 200 people per county to control the whole process, to go out and do all the necessary things in order to put individuals onto the ballot. And we need to do the same thing. We don't have to become a statutory committee man. Our founding fathers were not committee men by statutes. And even in that, there's a restricted number of people that can really participate with that process. In the process our founding fathers set up, anyone can participate, and as many people as want to can participate, and the more the merrier. And of course, the more people involved, the less less work that we have to do individually. So again, we don't have government by majority. We have government by the majority that participates, and approximately 200 people per county, some counties less, some counties more, so we'll just say an average, can take total control of the entire political process. And the people also need to take control of the entire judicial process, with the exception of course, the equity. Equity is up to judges. That's their sole purpose, is to rule in equity courts. They have no authority to rule, make a decision on anything in a court of law. That's up to the people. And that's why we have juries. So any individual that is a judge that might be sitting in a court of law, for instance, they are acting as a magistrate, or they should be acting as a magistrate. They have no real decision-making in that courtroom. Of course, they're acting like a traffic cop, making sure things proceed according to, you know, justice and righteousness and rules to some degree, rules of common law, let's call it that, not rules that they have put together by the Bar Association that the Supreme Court acknowledged as being the new rules of the court back in 1938. Of course, we're not talking about that. But judges are not to make the final decision. They're not to act outside of that authority and out of that criteria, out of that jurisdiction. They are only magistrates. And matter of fact, if you read through Black's and look into magistrates, and this comes from many rulings for the United States Supreme Court, all judges are magistrates. So, and magistrates are magistrates. You know, a magistrate that's not a judge, of course, they can sit in a court of law and operate as that traffic cop, so to speak, to keep the process going, keep law and order moving along. Now, I know I kind of was long-winded on that and took it in a couple of places, but I think it's necessary to realize these things. Next question, or
no, do we have anything else? That was the only question, John, that I have tonight.
Okay, any announcements?
Not really, no.
Okay. All right, just real quick, I'm planning on doing a seminar, at least I think I'm calling it a seminar, and it's going to be on the Committee of Safety, and it's going to be in Hyde Park, New York, and I'm kind of hoping many people from other counties will come in for the purpose of considering sparking off a Committee of Safety within their county, and we here at National Liberty Alliance will assist them in any way we can. But I'm going to start it off in my, at least here in New York, in my county. And so we're looking at the 4th, December 4th, which is a Saturday. And it'll be probably from 12 to 3, but we'll have the room till 4 in case we go further than that. I was going to try to broadcast it live through the room. I may still do that. I'm not sure. But I also thought about this, and I think we're going to do a national seminar, maybe after the 4th. We'll pick a date. And again, I can't confirm the 4th yet because I got to talk with the individual that we're getting a room from in order to have this seminar. We're using the gun club, Rod and Gun Club, here in Hyde Park, New York. And that's the perfect place to really have a seminar to have them ask that they would host it for us. And, you know, they charge you some money. Anytime, even when their members use the room for any kind of a purpose or an event, they charge them, you know, I think they said it was $75 or $100. I'm not a member of the Rod and Gun Club, so not being a member, they charge $150, which I think is reasonable. It's a pretty big room. We can seat about 85 chairs. I visited that room today. We have about 85 chairs there. It looks like we can take in, talking to some of the individuals, maybe 100 people. So once we announce and confirm this, anybody from, anybody that's going to attend this, we'd want them to really, we'll put an email address up for this purpose where people can let us know that they're attending, just in case, because we have had events some years ago where we had lots of people show up on a couple of different occasions, and again, you know, the seating is limited, so if we do get a lot of people, you know, we don't want people to travel or anything and not be able to get in because we filled all the seats. Of course, that's wishful thinking. I'm hoping we're going to have a packed house. I'm hoping we're going to have 100 people. I'm hoping, I am hoping that we have to turn people away. I mean, that's not nice, but you know, I think it's important that we should be really, this should be a big event. And I'm going to be traveling the state here in New York and eventually probably do some traveling into Connecticut and New Jersey and maybe even Pennsylvania and maybe even up in New England. I don't know. I'll see how it goes to assist people to spark off these committees of safety in their counties. And I'm hoping other people do the same thing. The program we're going to be doing is going to be, we're going to lay it out, okay, what this program is, and we will have, we'll have a short PowerPoint video, and we'll make that available to everybody, and it's going to be a PowerPoint program also, and we'll make that available to everyone, and this way everyone can do the same thing in their own counties, and again, anyone that feels that they're able to do it and would like to do it, they should travel their state also and connect with all of the different liberty groups in the different counties across their state and encourage people to get the committees of safety going. You know, getting one started in your county is a big thing, very important, and it's powerful, but it's a heck of a lot more powerful if you can get this going in every county or even just 80% of the counties in your state. And there is a person that's going to probably be working with me here in New York that's going to be working on the west side of the western part of New York, and I'm going to be working on the eastern side and southern part of New York, and again, get this out. We did do this some years ago. We did it with the committeeman process. Gerard and I traveled throughout New York and various other places in different states. We went out to Connecticut and got some things, some programs going. And then again, we did it again when we came forward with the Unified Common Law Grand Jury and also bringing people together under that process. And that was pretty successful. As a matter of fact, we had did the entire United States. We had people working in many, many states, just, you know, repeating what we were doing here. So what we're going to do here in New York, again, all the tools and all of the different necessary program necessary to really bring a good understanding of the Committee of Safety to the people and hopefully encourage them to join and get involved in this Committee of Safety so that we can have government by consent. The PowerPoint I'm going to do, I'm going to offer it in a couple of ways. I'm going to offer it as I'm going to record the PowerPoint, and then I'll have one unrecorded. So one will be a PowerPoint video, and another one will be a PowerPoint. And that might be easier for people. The people might want to do the video instead of articulating it themselves. But, you know, again, as time goes on, maybe someone doing that might eventually want to articulate it themselves also. Also, I'll make myself available, and I'll talk with Gerard and see if he can make himself available, just in case I'm not available at for a situation. And if anybody does a committee of safety, a seminar like we're doing on the Committee of Safety, Government by Consent, anybody who does that, and or any event that they do, and they would like for me to be involved with that, maybe during the Q&A session, then I'll make myself available, and I can come into the meeting through Skype or through Zoom or whatever program they might want to use in order to assist maybe in the Q&A section of it. Some people may not be comfortable enough. But you know what? You don't have to have all the answers. You don't have to know everything. You can just say, hey, I don't know the answer to that one's a good one. And, hey, maybe by the next meeting we can find the answer to that, okay? And they can explore it out and find it for themselves, or they can come to Monday night program and ask here, and we'll give them our thoughts on it. And if we don't have an answer, we'll find one for the following week to give it to them. We'll investigate it and research it and see what we can do. But this is the most important thing we the people can do. And I challenge anyone, and I've said this many times, and I'll say it again, I challenge anyone to show us any way that we can save this nation, any way that we can have government by consent without, A, the knowledge of who we are as a people, our heritage, our common law, and B, exercising our authority through the same process our founding fathers used, and it was used even in the early part of the colonies, and that is the Committee of Safety process. So it's a real eye-opener, this course, or what would I say, this seminar that we're putting together, I think it lays out the program pretty clearly. Try to keep it as short as possible on the one hand, but I know the video is 30 minutes long. It's a PowerPoint video, pretty powerful. And that's really just an introduction to the Committee of Safety and how that developed here in the United States and in the colonies first, of course, and in the United States. And it's been around for a long time. Then the second part, of course, is really expounding on the Committee of Safety, laying out the process and the procedure and everything involved with it. That's a PowerPoint. I'm kind of thinking that's going to take about 45 minutes to go through, an hour at the most. I know I get lost on things sometimes and I go quite long, but I'm really going to try to keep it at least, you know, what I'm going to present between 45 minutes to an hour. So let's say it goes an hour. So that's an hour and a half. And if we have a three-hour program, we have an hour and a half after that for discussion, questions, comments, and so on. But again, I'm setting things up for 4 hours just in case we go over and people are interested and we continue to talk. So we'll do that. We'll probably set something up maybe where people can have something. Maybe we'll bring some kind of refreshments or something. I don't know. I'll see how that part goes. But anyway, that's what we're doing here in New York. I encourage people to be doing this and follow this lead in your own state. or even here in New York. I mean, if people want to do it in different counties, and again, they want to do it themselves and then invite me into Zoom, or they just want to do it on themselves alone, that's fine too. This is a grassroots movement, and National Liberty Alliance is all about encouraging the people on the grassroots movement to get involved and to do it themselves and to figure out the problems and work out the situations. We're just going to give the framework, and we're going to give the education, and we're going to give the support. Any questions or anything comes up or any assistance that people need, we'll give them that support. But NLA is a hands-off on the grassroots, because we have to have the grassroots government by consent, by the people themselves at the grassroots. This is what it takes to have liberty. If we don't do this, we'll never really have a free and independent, the people will never be free and independent, let's put it that way. And we will never have government by consent. Maybe a little here, a little there, but ignorance will get us nothing. Ignorance will only get us in trouble. So, what was it I heard? I think the statement goes, it's not what you don't know that hurts you, it's what you think you know and is wrong. That's what's going to hurt you, and you know, that you don't know. So, anyway, that's all I have to say about that. Okay, and Jan, you said there was no announcements, right?
Yep. Brent is here, I think.
Okay, I see him. All right. Okay, one other thing. We do need assistance on the national level. Anybody who wants to give us some of their time, we'd appreciate it. I need someone really that would kind of take, we got a lot of MP3s that we've been doing every Monday, all these different programs we've had. We've got lots of MP3s of different radio programs that I've been on and Gerard has been on. So there's a lot of Q&A in a lot of this stuff. And what I'd like to do, we spoke about this once before, but we never really got to it. But I'd like to do is, if we can get someone to do this for us, is to go through some of these programs and start to cut the MP3s into pieces, so where you have just the question and the answer, and then we can create a question and answer page where people can hear the answer in audio. So anybody who has that ability to do that and would like to do that for us and assist us, we'd really appreciate it. And again, we need help in every area here at National Liberty Alliance, so there's a lot of openings for people to get involved here on the national level. More importantly, though, of course, is people getting involved on the local level. Anybody involved on the national level should be involved on their local level in their own counties. Even if they don't take up a leadership role in their own counties, that's fine, but you should be involved in your committee of safety. Every single one of us should be involved, because that's the only way we can have government by consent. Okay, tonight we're going to, let me see if there's anything else before we move on. Okay, I guess that's pretty much it. Okay, tonight's topic is the Second Amendment. I'm not sure how long this is, I forget, but you know, I've been trying to keep them short, 30 minutes or less. Some of them are a lot less because I've been working on a lot of them lately, and I really like to keep it short and stay focused on one subject as we move along. And these will all be available on our webpage. As a matter of fact, some of them are already available up on our web. I forget exactly where it's at, but maybe a little later I'll show you where it's at. I'll look for it, and if not, next Monday for sure. So, okay, so tonight we're going to be looking at, again, the Second Amendment. And anybody's got any questions or comments or corrections, you can hit *6 and a 1, and you'll be into the queue. We're open right now for a Q&A, but only questions on this subject matter. Then after that, Brent will be taking the mic for a while, and then we'll go back into, after Brent is done, we'll go back into an open conversation, an open forum, and then any question, comment, or correction on any subject matter at that point, we'll open at that point. Okay, so here we go. Second Amendment. Bill of Rights, Second Amendment. A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, shall not be infringed. Just real quick, I want to check. This video is coming through, is it not?
Yes, it looks good.
Okay. All right. The people must guard and defend liberty, if necessary, by the exercising of unalienable rights secured by the Second Amendment when called upon. Liberty is a blessing of God that few have found. It's immunity from all foreign control, that is to say, government. It's the power of acting as one thinks fit without any restraint or control, unless by the laws of nature's God. It includes and comprehends all personal rights and their enjoyments. It was founded in righteousness, and when proclaimed, it had to be defended with blood. Its price is eternal vigilance. Patrick Henry said, "Is life so dear or peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death." Liberty in this world is rare, and history recalls that it was gifted and lost only once in 1400 BC by the nation of Israel. And in 1776, it was gifted a second time to the people who are called by his name, Christians. And today, it is the duty of the people to secure it before it is lost again. In Genesis chapter 1, verse 28, God blessed his children and commanded them to subdue the earth. We must never let the weight of the deep state endanger our republic or its liberty. We should take nothing for granted. We must guard against those who for millennium strive to possess our land by deceit and by force, and to fill the face of the world with their dark cities. It is the people's duty to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. And therefore, we the people codified our sovereign unalienable right via the Second Amendment in that a well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state, for the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Noah Webster, An Examination of Leading Principles of the Federal Constitution, October 10, 1787. Before a standing army can rule, the people must be disarmed, as they are in almost every country in Europe. The supreme power in America cannot enforce unjust laws by the sword, because the whole body of the people are armed and constitute a force superior to any band of regular troops. Who are the militia? George Mason, I ask, who are the militia? They consist now of the whole people, except a few public officers. Trent Koch, the Pennsylvania Gazette, 1788. The militia of these free commonwealths, entitled and accustomed to their arms, when compared with any possible army, must be tremendous and irresistible. Who are the militia? Are they not ourselves? Is it feared, then, that we turn our arms each man against his own bosom? Congress have no power to disarm the militia. Their swords and every other terrible implement of the soldiers are the birthright of an American. The unlimited power of the sword is not in the hands of either the federal or the state governments, but where I trust in God, it will ever remain in the hands of the people. George Mason, Virginia Declaration of Rights, 1776. That a well-regulated militia composed of the body of the people trained to arms is the proper, natural, and safe defense of a free state. New York State Constitution, Article 12, Section 1. The defense and protection of the state in the United States is the obligation of all persons within the state. The legislature shall provide for the discharge of this obligation and for the maintenance and regulation of an organized militia. Richard Henry Lee, Federalist, Number 18. A militia, when properly formed, is in fact the people themselves, and include, according to the past and general usage of the states, all men capable of bearing arms. To preserve liberty, it is essential that the whole body of the people always possess arms, and be taught alike, especially when young, how to use them. James Madison, 1789. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. A well-regulated militia, composed of the body of the people trained to arms, is the best and most natural defense of a free country. Our Constitution and the right to keep arms. If the people have no experience with arms, how can they defend themselves, neighbors, and our nation if called upon? George Washington. The Constitution is to be never construed to authorize Congress to infringe the just liberty of the people of the United States, who are peaceable citizens, from keeping their own arms. Thomas Jefferson, Virginia Constitution. No free man shall ever be debarred the use of arms. Thomas Jefferson. The laws that forbid the carrying of arms are laws of such a nature. They disarm only those who are neither inclined nor determined to commit crimes. Such laws make things worse for the assaulted and better for the assaultants. They serve rather to encourage than to prevent homicides. For an unarmed man may be attacked with greater confidence than an armed man. George Mason, 1788. To disarm the people is the most effectual way to enslave them. Blackstone's Commentaries on the Laws of England, 1803. This may be considered as the true polarium of liberty. The right of self-defense is the first law of nature in most governments. It has been the study of rulers to confine this right within the narrowest limits possible. Wherever standing armies are kept up, and the right of the people to keep and bear arms is under any color or pretext whatsoever forbidden, liberty, if not already annihilated, is on the brink of destruction. Thomas Jefferson. What country can preserve its liberties if their rulers are not warned from time to time that their people preserve the spirit of resistance? Let them take arms. Our founding fathers in the Second Amendment. I prefer dangerous freedom over peaceful slavery. Thomas Jefferson. Patrick Henry, speech to the Virginia Ratifying Convention, June 5, 1778. Guard with jealous attention the public liberty. Suspect everyone who approaches that jewel. Unfortunately, nothing will preserve it but downright force. Whenever you give up that force, you are ruined. The great object is that every man be armed. Everyone who is able might have a gun. Thomas Jefferson, letter to John Cartwright, June 5, 1824. The Constitution of most of the states and of the United States assert that all power is inherent in the people, that they may exercise it by themselves, that it is their right and their duty to be at all times armed. John Adams, in a speech to U.S. Congress, January 8, 1790, said, "A free people ought not only to be armed, but disciplined." Benjamin Franklin, democracy is two wolves and a lamb voting on what to have for lunch. Liberty is a well-armed lamb contesting the vote. Thomas Jefferson, letter to Peter Carr, August 19, 1785. A strong body makes the mind strong. As to the species of exercise, I advise the gun. While this gives moderate exercise to the body, it gives boldness, enterprise, and independence to the mind. Let your gun, therefore, be your constant companion of your walks. Patrick Henry, debates in the several state conventions on the adoption of the federal Constitution. Are we all at last brought to such humiliation and debasement, degradation, that we cannot be trusted with arms for our defense? Where is the difference between having our arms in possession and under our direction, and having them under the management of Congress? If our defense be the real object of having those arms, in whose hands can they be trusted with more propriety or equal safety to us as in our hands? Samuel Adams, Massachusetts, Ratifying Convention, 1788. And that the said Constitution be never construed to prevent the people of the United States, who are peaceable citizens, from keeping their own arms. Joseph Story, Commentaries on the Constitution of the United States, 1833. The right of the citizens to keep and bear arms has justly been considered as the polaritum of the liberties of a republic, since it offers a strong moral check against the usurpation and arbitrary power of rulers, and will generally, even if these are successful in the first instance, enable the people to resist and triumph over them. Alexander Hamilton, Federalist, number 28. If the representatives of the people betray their constituents, there is then no resource left but in the exertion of their original right of self-defense, which is paramount to all positive forms of government, and which against the usurpation of the national rulers may be exerted with infinity better prospect of success than against those of the rulers of an individual state. Trent Cox, Philadelphia Federal Gazette, June 18, 1789. As civil rulers, not having their duty to the people before them, may attempt to tyrannize, and as the military forces which must be occasionally raised to defend our country might pervert their power to the injury of their fellow citizens, the people are confirmed by the article in their right to keep and bear their private arms. John Dickinson, July 6, 1775. With hearts fortified with these animating reflections, we most solemnly before God and the world declare that exerting the utmost energy of those powers which our beneficent Creator hath graciously bestowed upon us, the arms we have compelled by our enemies to assume, we will, in defiance of every hazard, with unabating firmness and perseverance, employ for the preservation of our liberties, being with one mind resolved to die freemen rather than to live as slaves. Roger Sherman, Debates on 1790 Militia Act. Conceived it to be the privilege of every citizen and one of his most essential rights to bear arms and to resist every attack upon his liberty or property by whomsoever made, the particular states, like private citizens, have a right to be armed and to defend by force of arms their rights when invaded. Zachariah Johnson, Virginia Ratifying Convention, June 25, 1788. The people are not to be disarmed of their weapons. They are left in full possession of them. Why governments disarm people? A League of Evil. The following statistics were reported in September 11, 1999 issue of the Economicist magazine, page 7, titled A League of Evil. 1915 to 1917, Ottoman Turkey banned gun possessions and then targeted Armenians, mostly Christians, and killed 1.5 million people. 1929 to 1945, Soviet Union banned gun possessions and then targeted political opponents and farming communities, killing 20 million people. 1933 to 1945, Nazi Germany and occupied Egypt banned gun possessions and then targeted political opponents, Jews, Gypsies, and critics, killing 20 million people. 1927 to 1949, Nationalist China banned private ownership of guns and then targeted political opponents, army conscripts, and others, killing 10 million people. 1949 to 1952, 1957 through 1960, and 1966 through 1976, Red China instituted the death penalty for supplying guns to counter-revolutionary criminals, and anyone resisting any government program, and then they targeted political opponents, killing 20 to 35 million people. 1960 to 1981, Guatemala banned gun possession and then targeted Mayans, other Indians, and political enemies, killing 100,000 to 200,000 people. 1971 to 1979, Uganda. Registered gun owners instituted warrantless searches and then targeted Christians and political enemies, killing 300,000 people. 1994, Rwanda. Registered gun owners then targeted the Tutsi people, killing over 800,000 people. Unarmed people have no defense against a demonical government. In the 20th century alone, governments killed a total of 262 million civilians. Nobel Peace Prize finalist R.J. Rummel, in an update to statistics originally presented in his Death by Government Transaction publishes 1994. Disarmament under the guise of necessity. The rulers of this world tell us that in order to be free and secure, it is necessary for us to give up our arms and trust them with our security and safety. But history has shown us that necessity is the plea for every infringement of human freedom. It is the argument of tyrants. It is the creed of slaves. As Benjamin Franklin said, "They that give up essential liberties to obtain a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety." The history of the servants within our present government, like our founding fathers of yesterday, is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having a direct object, the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. God warned us that we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against rulers of darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. Wherefore, take unto you the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. Ephesians 6. Liberty is twofold. First, it is deliverance from the bondage of the flesh, and thereby liberating us in the spirit, whereby we then walk in morality and live by natural law's principles clothed with his spiritual armor. Second, it is a political liberty from the tyrants of the world, whereas the latter is not possible without the former. And as God commanded Israel to be armed and drive their enemies away, we too must bear the earthly armor to drive our enemies away. Disarmament in the name of security. Acts of treason. On September 25, 2013, in an act of war against the unalienable rights of the people, protected by Amendment 2, against the will of we the people and without our consent, Secretary of State John Kerry committed treason by covertly signing the United Nations Arms Trade Treaty, thereby surrendering the people's unalienable rights protected by the Second Amendment to foreign powers, inapplicable to liberty. On September 24, 2014, while addressing the UN General Assembly concerning the United Nations Arms Trade Treaty, in an act of war against the unalienable rights of the people protected by the Amendment 2, against the will of we the people, President Obama said, "All nations must meet our responsibility to observe and enforce international norms," thereby covertly yielding his oath of office to foreign powers. On December 24, 2014, Christmas Eve, the United Nations Arms Trade Treaty covertly became binding on the nations that have ratified, signed by John Kerry. Under fiction of law, the treaty provides the basis for additional gun regulations in America under the guise of necessity. The conclusion is inescapable. History clearly teaches that every government that moves towards gun control ends up killing the people who disagree with it. Disarmed people are neither free nor safe. Rather, they become the criminal's prey and the tyrant's playthings. When people are defenseless and their government goes rogue, thousands and millions of innocents die. Report of the Subcommittee on the Constitution of the Committee on the Judiciary, United States Senate, 97th Congress, Second Session. The conclusion is thus inescapable that the history, concept, and wording of the Second Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, as well as its interpretation by every major commentator and court in the first half century after its ratification, indicates that what is protected is an individual right of a private citizen to own and carry firearms in a peaceful manner. Stephen P. Halbrook, that every man be armed. In recent years, it has been suggested that the Second Amendment protects the collective right of the states to maintain militias, while it does not protect the right of the people to keep and bear arms. If anyone entertains this notion in the period during which the Constitution and the Bill of Rights were debated and ratified, it remains one of the most closely guarded secrets of the 18th century, for no known writing surviving from this period between 1787 and 1791 states such a thesis. Yoshimi Ishikawa, Japanese author and social commentator, Los Angeles Times, October 15, 1992. Americans have the will to resist because you have weapons. If you don't have a gun, freedom of speech has no power. Robert Onsen, 1949. Whether the authorities be invaders or merely local tyrants, the effect of such laws, gun control, is to place the individual at the mercy of the state, unable to resist. In the Militia Act of 1792, the Second Congress defined militia of the United States to include almost every free adult male in the United States. These persons were obligated by law to possess a firearm with a minimum supply of ammunition and military equipment. This statute, incidentally, remained in effect into the early years of the 20th century as a legal requirement of gun ownership for most of the population of the United States. There can be little doubt from this that when the Congress and the people spoke of a militia, they had reference to the traditional concept of the entire populace capable of bearing arms, and not to any formal group such as what is today called the National Guard. The purpose was to create an armed citizenry, which the political theorist at the time considered essential to warn off tyranny. Colin Greenwood, in the study Firearms Control, 1972. No matter how one approaches the figures, one is forced to the rather startling conclusion that the use of firearms in crimes was very much less when there were no controls of any sort, and when anyone, convicted criminal or lunatic, could buy any type of firearm without restrictions. Half a century of strict controls on pistols has ended perversely with a far greater use of this weapon in crime than ever before. Alan Dershowitz, Harvard Law Professor, quoted in a Capitalism magazine article, The Second Amendment Strikes Back, by Larry Elder, June 3, 2002. Those who are trying to read the Second Amendment out of the Constitution by claiming that it's an individual right, that it's not a individual right, or that it's too much of a safety hazard, are courting disaster by encouraging others to use the same means to eliminate portions of the Constitution they don't like. Mao Zedong. Every communist must grasp the truth. Political power grows out of the barrel of a gun. Senator Orrin Hatch, January 20, 1982, in a preface to the report on the Subcommittee on the Constitution for the Committee on the Judiciary, United States Senate, 97th Congress, Second Session. We did not speculate as to the intent of the framers of the Second Amendment. We examined James Madison's draft for it. His handwritten outlines of speeches upon the Bill of Rights and the discussions of the Second Amendment by early scholars who were personal friends of Madison, Jefferson, and Washington, and wrote while these still lived. What the Subcommittee on the Constitution uncovered was clear and long-lost proof that the Second Amendment to our Constitution was intended as an individual right of the American citizens to keep and bear arms in a peaceful manner for the protection of himself, his family, and his freedoms. U.S. Department of Justice, Office of Justice Program, Urban Delinquency and Substance Abuse Research Summary, 74% of the illegal gun owners commit street crimes, 24% commit gun crimes, and 41% use drugs. Boys who own legal firearms, however, have much lower rates of delinquency and drug use, and are even slightly less delinquent than non-gun owners. The socialization into gun ownership is also vast difference for legal and illegal gun owners. Those who own legal guns have fathers who own guns for sport and hunting. On the other hand, those who own illegal guns have friends who own illegal guns and are far more likely to be gang members. For legal gun owners, socialization appears to take place in the family. For illegal gun owners, it appears to take place on the streets. Both oligarch and tyrant mistrust the people and therefore deprive them of arms. Aristotle. John R. Bolton, as United States Undersecretary for Arms Control and International Security, urged the United Nations in 2001 to recognize how an oppressed non-state group defending itself from a genocidal government will need ready access to firearms. Mr. Bolton may have been the first U.S. official in modern history to argue before the UN that private citizens might need to be armed against their own killer governments. Hitler. The most foolish mistake we could possibly make would be to permit the conquered Eastern peoples to have arms. History teaches that all conquerors who have allowed their subject races to carry arms have prepared their own downfall by doing so. In a radio interview with Walton and Johnson, January 17, 2013, Ron Paul said, "They will come with their guns to take our guns." In 1962, President John F. Kennedy said, "Those who make peaceful revolutions impossible will make violent revolutions inevitable." He went on to say, "Today we need a nation of Minutemen, citizens who are not only prepared to take up arms, but citizens who regard the preservation of freedom as a basic purpose of their duty, of their daily life, and who are willing to consciously work and sacrifice for that freedom." Governments have murdered four times as many civilians as were killed in all the international and domestic wars combined. How could governments kill so many people? The governments had the power. The people, the victims, were unable to resist because the victims were unarmed. Clearly, in this world, the right to defend ourselves against the dark forces in this world is the necessity. Join our campaign for constitutional sheriffs. Go to nationallibertyalliance.org/county-sheriff-project. Join us to save a republic by learning the science of government by consent. Come to our weekly live open forums every Monday, 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. Take our free civics course. Learn real American history. Take our government by consent course. Learn how to file a court case. Learn the difference between law and equity. Learn the Constitution. Learn natural law, also known as common law. Learn the true meaning of liberty. Learn how we, the people, can reinstate our natural law courts of justice. As Thomas Jefferson said, if a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be. An enlightened citizenry is indispensable for the proper functioning of a republic. Self-government is not possible unless the citizens are educated sufficiently to enable them to exercise oversight. It is therefore imperative that the nation see to it that a suitable education be provided for all its citizens. Educate and inform the whole mass of the people. They are the only sure reliance for the preservation of our liberty. Okay, I don't see anyone in the queue, But if anybody has any questions, comments, or corrections that they'd like to add, they can maybe pick that up in our next, when we open up for an open conversation or questions and answers. Gerard, are you ready to take the mic? I got to run out real quick because I have a puppy here that's yelling at me. So, yeah, I see Brent. Brent, are you ready to take the mic? Brent?
Yes, I'm head. It is amazing how long it takes to find that mic.
I know.
I know where it is, but I got to drag stuff around and try, you know. Yeah. Anyway, but yeah, I'm here. Thank you.
Okay, Gerard, you going to take the board?
Yep.
All right, I'll be back in a short. I got to run out with this puppy. She's yelling at me. All right, we're going to turn things over to Brent Winters for a while. He's the author of The Excellence of the Common Law and other books. And his website is commonlawyer.com. You got the mic.
Thank you. Thank you, John. This is Brent Allen Winters, commonlawyer.com. www.commonlawyer.com. Well, during the reading, Alexander Scorby was reading from Luke chapter 10, and that narrative that people call the parable of the Samaritan, the parable of the good Samaritan, they call it. And of course, it's not a parable at all. It's something that really happened. The parable always begins with the kingdom of heaven is like or as. It's a comparative parable. Parabole, throw down beside it and compare it. But he didn't throw anything down beside anything there. He just said a certain man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho and he fell among thieves and they robbed him, beat him half to death, stole his clothes and left him lying naked along the side of the road. And of course, after the story, or before the story, the lawyer, and I had, he was a canon civil law lawyer, a scholastic, because he was a follower of Babylonian Judaism. That's the only kind of lawyer they had in that nation at that time. And he asked a question. He said, "Who is my neighbor?" Now, if you read that narrative, just read it closely and think about what you're reading, you'll discover that Jesus Christ never did answer his question. He never did. Never did he answer his question. What was his question again? Who is my neighbor? Well, why did he ask that question? Well, it says he was seeking to justify himself. If he could get the definition he wanted, then he was justified, he thought. Well, he was all wrong. Two things he was wrong on, and Jesus Christ, in the most clever manipulations of words and the situation, it's mind-boggling. The more you read that, the more you really, you think that he never answered the question, well, then what did he do? Well, what essentially he said was, is your problem is you can never get to the right answer if you keep asking the wrong questions. And to get to an answer that helps you, you got to ask the right question. And he never did that. He was asking the wrong question, seeking to justify himself, instead of seeking the one who would justify him, because that's what he needed. That's what we all need. We can't justify ourselves by anything we do. But there is one that justifies us, and that's what that story is about. Who was him that fell among, or who was neighbor? Not who is my neighbor, but who was neighborly? See, that's the question he should have been asking. Who's neighborly to you? Not who is my neighbor. Or is the answer, well, I'll let you go read it and figure it out, who's the one that's really neighborly here, that we should be seeking instead of seeking to justify ourselves. Well, he asked the right question. How'd a fellow ask a question? We're in this sheriff's class on Thursday mornings, and Sheriff Darleaf is nice enough to be there, and then I'll say something, and then I'll ask Sheriff Darr, well, what do you got to say about that, Sheriff? You got anything you want to add? And he's usually got something, some experience or some insight that he's gained in the last 17 or 18 years being sheriff. But one guy wrote in, and he asked a question. And he said, I want you to resolve this problem for me. I said, I heard Brent say that if we see government doing something and it makes us a little bit uneasy, we should ask ourselves, if there were no government, could I or my friends rightly do what the government's doing? If there were no government, could I or my friends do what the government's doing? And then I said, as a general matter, if you see government doing something that you don't think you and your friends could do if there were no government, well, then, like the government couldn't be doing that. Why? Well, because government doesn't have any authority to do anything that you didn't give to them. All of their authority to exercise power, and there's a distinction between those two things, authority and power, right and might, there's a difference between the two. The people of the United States do not give authority to government to do a certain thing, they have no authority. And you don't have any authority to do wrong, then how could you possibly give authority to the government to do wrong? Well, the fact is you can't. None of us can. We collectively can't do that. No man under any circumstances ever has the right to do wrong. Period. End of discussion. That's a principle that is incontrovertible, unchangeable, immovable. It will never change. And just because somebody wears a badge doesn't mean he can't do any wrong. No, he does do wrong. Just because somebody holds an office doesn't mean he can't do wrong. Well, I said that. And then this fellow said, then you turned around and said, Brent, you turned around and said that the sheriff can press me into his service, demand obedience from me if he needs to, and I have to obey or I'll be subject to criminal prosecution. He said that can't be true. It can't be both ways. If I don't give him authority to do that, then how can that happen if I don't want to do it? Well, that's an important question, but he's asking the wrong question, of course. That's my conclusion. The question is, well, you can phrase it in that old phrase, I ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country, which, of course, wasn't Kennedy's. He would quote another fellow on that. But there is a right question, and there is a wrong question. But in that vein, I, of course, like to research the law, and I looked into this a little bit. So, because National Liberty Alliance is nice enough to let me say a few words, I want to tell you some of the things I'm finding about the power of the sheriff to tell people what to do. Well, that's the posse, you see. Once he impresses you into service and he says, I need help right now, do this, and you don't do it, in every state, as far as I know, that has a sheriff, and that's almost all of them, you're subject to criminal prosecution if you don't do that. And there's a fine or a jail time or something. Every state's a little different. The posse comitatus is the power. That means the posse, power, comitatus, county. Posse is the possibility, the potential power of the county. And the sheriff has no power unless he can command the able-bodied males of the county to help him. If he needs it. To help him do what? To arrest a fleeing man, a fleeing fugitive, for instance, to help him wrestle a man down if he has to help him hold a man, to even exert deadly force if necessary. Now, there's a whole lot of law that goes with all this, and I can never cover it all. There are so many cases that American courts have handed down upon this point. The power and authority of a sheriff to raise the posse comitatus for the purpose of executing process, even serving legal papers, existed at common law from time immemorial. This is nothing new, and is confirmed, the statutes confirm it. In most of our states, the legislature has passed enforcing statutes to agree with our common law tradition on that point. And even Parliament before America had done that in England. And Parliament, when they did that, all they're doing is recognizing the tradition of the common law, the power of the sheriff to command able-bodied males to help him do certain things. And over the centuries, there is a list of things that he has authority to command able-bodied males to do. And even males that are not able-bodied, depending upon the circumstances and what they're able to do. Able for the task. If you're able for the task he's commanding you to do and you don't do it, you can be prosecuted for a crime. Sometimes it's a misdemeanor. Sometimes it's more. But the authority of the sheriff to raise the posse, that's short for posse comitatus, the possibility or the power of the county, or to summon, otherwise summon bystanders, it's sometimes called, to assist him, applies in many instances and circumstances. But if a sheriff meets with resistance in doing a lawful duty, then he has that power to, oh, by the way, if the sheriff impresses you into service as a member of the posse, then you have the power to impress others into service to assist you to do what he has told you to do. That's the law. And it has always been the law. Well, the right to command the power of the county, that's the posse, the power of the country, is the way they used to say it in England, to the end that arrest may be made or criminal process executed, is utterly undoubted in our country as a matter of law. It's the power to call upon bystanders to aid a sheriff. That's not confined merely to making an arrest, but also extends to suppression of breaches of the peace, drunks. They're wrecking havoc on the streets or in a drinking establishment. It seems, when you read the cases, that the sheriff has the authority to gather the posse to himself or any part of it. Whenever he's doing something and needs help doing something that is within his jurisdiction and responsibility to do. And a bystander who has no office that he holds, no authority, may also, as I had said before, he may also summon a bystander to assist him in making an arrest that the sheriff has told him to help do. And even without a warrant. Because of the exigency of the circumstances, by the time the sheriff is assembling the posse, there's not much time for raise your right hand and repeat after me. Oh, there could be, and sometimes that's done. But if there isn't, he still has that power. Remember, no oath that any man ever took ever added any duty, any new duty to him. No oath that any man ever took ever added any new duty that he didn't already have. No, the oath doesn't add a duty. The oath just affirms and strengthens a duty you already have. And this oath that office holders, our Constitution requires them to take, every office holder, our Constitution says, both state and federal, must swear, or you could put it in the passive, probably more accurate, be sworn to defend the Constitution of the United States against its foreign enemies and its domestic enemies. And therein is the two fundamental functions of government, the indispensable fundamental functions of government: to defend against enemies foreign, that's armed defense, and to defend against enemies domestic, that's the duty to serve on the jury. Well, a mere volunteer who might want to join the posse, cannot of his own volition, of his own will, and without any lawful request or command, join in helping the sheriff. No, he has to ask you. Now, he can, that's the law, he can ratify your voluntary help. He can do that. But if he never asks you, never commands you, then you have no duty to do anything. That's the point I'm making, and that's the point that the courts have made throughout the history of our country. Well, the reason for such a rule that you don't have a duty to help him unless he commands you to do so is because the sheriff's assembling of a posse is under a duty to not summons a bystander who he knows or has discovered has a tendency to do violence to a prisoner taken under arrest. The sheriff has discretion, you see, to choose at any given point who he's going to ask to help him. And if he asks somebody to help him and he discovers that he's a vicious, violent man out to hurt people, he also has a duty to tell him to stop and get out of there. And if he doesn't do it, he'd have a duty to use force to stop him. Now, these are things I'm saying are what the cases in America have always said. And it behooves every sheriff, especially the sheriff, to know these standards. And every deputy. And nobody's teaching them. It's up to us to do that. It's up to you to learn them. Because if you learn them, you'll talk about them. And it'll seep over and grow and become part of the consciousness of the sheriffs and deputies where you live. Let me continue with some of this. Lawful member of posse comitatus may do whatever the sheriff might lawfully do once he's commanded to join and help the sheriff, and he's shielded by the same indemnity, the same immunity that clothes the sheriff himself, as long as you're acting within the law. You step outside the jurisdiction of the sheriff, the duties that an authority he's been delegated, you can get sued and get your pants sued off. You could even go to jail for a crime. This is a high duty. To be able to help the sheriff intelligently and keep your butt out of the sling at the same time means you have to know the law. You have to know it, not know about it. You have to have a feel for it. You know, what I'm saying to you now is just what lawyers do. They read things and they just kind of mull them over in their head. That's the way you learn the law. And that is the way you fulfill your responsibility, and it's up to you to know what your duty is as a member of the state militia and the posse, to know what the limits of your action have to be so that you do not transgress the law and thereby hurt somebody else's life, liberty, or property. What is your duty? God calls all men to be preoccupied with law. All men to be preoccupied in their minds with law. And if you aren't, you're part of the problem. You're damnable. Change your ways. Get a bug in your bonnet to learn the first principles of what God requires of you. Let me go on. A posse person, a person summoned to respond to the call of the sheriff to help him, again, may do legally whatever the officer himself, the sheriff, may lawfully do. And they're afforded, as I'd said, the same protection that he has as long as he acts within the scope of his authority. The scope of his authority. The scope of his authority. What's the word that means scope of authority? Jurisdiction. Authority is a general word. General word for right. Jurisdiction is a synonym that stresses the scope of your right, your duty, your authority. So the power of a sheriff to call upon a private person to assist him in the performing of functions of his office is without question in America. And when such a person as the sheriff requests to help, he must comply under pain of penalty of the law. And there are statutes in many states that prescribe the punishment. And in some states, if there aren't any statutes, the common law will prescribe and already has prescribed the punishment. And a citizen, there's that word that John was talking about a while ago. It's an unfortunate word that we have. Our Puritan forebears didn't use the word. They said we were freemen. Not citizens, freemen. Well, does that make sense? You bet it does. There's a definite difference, of course. And we ought to get in the habit of using the word freeman. Not citizenship, freemanship. Citizen is a word of the law of the city. It's from a Latin root that means city. City. City law, not law of the land, our constitution. Our common law is law of the land. Words do have meanings and they're powerful. Well, a person summoned to posse duty is not liable for obedience in good faith to the commands of a sheriff, even though the sheriff himself may be a trespasser and may be commanding the bystander he has summoned in a way that would make him otherwise be a trespasser. Now, the sheriff may be liable, but the one he's commanding, if he obeys in good faith, believing himself to be correct, will not be liable. Well, if someone is summoned, the sheriff summons someone to help him make an arrest, the person summoned has no duty to be concerned with the guilt or the innocence of the party charged, or the fact that false evidence had been given by a grand jury to obtain the warrant for his arrest. And he won't be liable one way or the other for that reason. And before the man summoned, the bystander, the sheriff summoned, may be charged with any criminal offense for failing to assist a sheriff. It is necessary that the command be issued by the sheriff. That stands to reason. But if a freeman is called upon to assist a sheriff, the lawfulness of his acts are not allowed to be questioned in a proceeding against him, and he will be exonerated as long as the law is followed. Well, if someone is summoned to duty as a member of a posse, he must act under the commands and within the scope of the commands of the sheriff commanding him. For what reason can a sheriff lawfully assemble a posse? Remember, posse again, posse comitatus. It's short for posse comitatus, Latin word, means the possibility or the power of the county. These are Latin words that mean power of the county. It is a general rule as to when the necessity exists for calling upon the freemen of a county performing the posse is left to the sound judgment and reasonable discretion of the sheriff himself. Not a lot said about this, if you'll notice. You don't hear a lot about it. It's there. The posse is used in thousands of counties in America constantly. And there's seldom a problem. That's why there aren't many cases that come up that you hear about. Of course, the evil empire, if there are any that come up, they don't want you to know about it. And it is a duty. If anybody has reason to anticipate resistance in the carrying out or the discharge of the duties of the sheriff's office, he has a duty to provide a force of men as would enable him to properly, efficiently, and promptly perform the duties of his office of sheriff. And he is liable, by the way, according to recent cases, the sheriff is liable if he has a duty to do and he can only do it with this power of the county called the posse, and he doesn't assemble the posse, then he's liable. We learned that from the cases back in Baltimore, Maryland, during the race riots of 1968, when the people that were rioting burnt down a good portion of the businesses in the city. The businessmen sued the city and said the city should assemble the posse. They said, well, we couldn't assemble the police. I don't remember what the reason was. It had to do with money. And they said, well, okay, so you couldn't assemble the police. You had the power to assemble the posse. The mayor had that power, and he didn't do it. And the appellate court agreed and said, that's right. The city has to pay these business owners money, because if they had just assembled the posse, even if the rioters had burned down their businesses, the city would not have been liable if they had done all within their power under the law to do, and they didn't. What didn't they do? They didn't call the posse. It cannot be considered a hardship on an officer, such as a sheriff, to impose the duty that he provide resistance which may reasonably anticipate is going to happen. If he sees something's about to happen, or he thinks something has a good chance of happening that could necessitate more power than he has at hand, the law says he has to do all he can to summon the posse. How many sheriffs would be able to summons the true power of their county? What's the true power? That means every able-bodied man, armed. How many sheriffs could do that? Do they have the telephone numbers of every able-bodied man? Do they have a list? You know, in England, for a few centuries, well, during Anglo-Saxon England, before the year 1066, every person that was in any shire, they called them shires, before 1066, called the shires, what became counties after that. Any person that stayed within any shire for 40 days or more, as soon as he hit 40 days, if he'd been there, he had a duty to go down and give his name and his address to the sheriff, put him on the rolls in case he needed him. That's how they kept the peace. You see, government is not just the sheriff's responsibility. It's every man's responsibility. And if it's every man's responsibility, every man feels a duty and a stake in the welfare of his community, his county, his township. Not only that, every man that is a part of that group, every old man has a camaraderie with every young upcoming man. It draws the community together in a common experience. What is the common experience? The common experience of what the Anglo-Saxons called the furred fare, what we call the militia. The militia. A common experience. What's that common experience? Armed defense, being available to the sheriff's call, that's the posse, to the governor's call, that's the militia, same guys, just analogous institutions and same guys. A little bit different because the sheriff has a more local duty. And where a sheriff receives a hurried call to go into the countryside on a cold, dark, stormy, wintry night to arrest a drunken man who appears likely to harm his family or somebody else, and then the sheriff knows him to be dangerous when inebriated, this is an emergency under the law warranting a calling upon able-bodied men for aid. And under such circumstances, the sheriff is not required to wait until he has reached an isolated farmhouse on such a night, where other men are unlikely to be found, before calling for help. An emergency does not mean that the sheriff is to proceed so cautiously at a time when he is in the extreme necessity for help, no help can be had. No help can be had. After all, his determinations of the existing of the emergency or the necessity for immediate aid are matters that must of necessity be left mainly to the exercise of his sober judgment and sound discretion on the part of him. Well, such is the law of the posse. Such is the law of the posse. This is not new. This is very old and very applicable as we speak now. And again, we agree, as John had said, and as he always says, we can't remain ignorant. Ignorant of what? Ignorant of true law. We need to hear about it. We need to talk about it. We need to be around people that like to talk about it. We need to get together like you folks are doing on Monday night so we can talk about it. The comments that John read were enlightening. Well, what's he trying to do? He's just trying to get the word out. Get it out there. If it gets out there, it'll get down in mental sod, then it becomes known. And it will permeate your brain and then other people's, and it can change the whole society. In fact, it will, for good or ill, if the right information is promulgated. Well, this is Brent Allen Winters, commonlawyer.com, www.commonlawyer.com. Join us for the sheriff's class. You can go to commonlawyer.com and see there how to sign up for the class. We've got one more session left. If you sign up, you can go to that session. You can still go back. It's evergreen. You can go back and watch and listen to all of them up to that point. There are other courses there that are available. Two sessions remain, not one. Yeah, we're moving into number 11 of 12 this Thursday. But it's always there, and people are constantly signing up. Then the next course we want to teach is concerning the grand jury. That's the one people have pressed us for, and I think it's a needful course too. What I'm trying to do is teach the things, the courses, that I should have been taught in law school but never was. So I have it in the plan to teach a course on the four militia clauses of our Constitution. That should be taught in law school. Why isn't it? Well, I know why it isn't. No sense talking about it now, but there's reasons. They're not good, but they're there. That's what we're trying to do. And if you finish all the courses, I'm up to 18 courses I want to get through. We've been through about a half a dozen. And they're all evergreen. You can go back and listen to them and get credit for them. And we want to provide what Blackstone called a gentleman's education. Well, what's a gentleman? Well, that's an interesting question, too. A gentleman? You know, that's some kind of an unwritten rank in Britain. But a gentleman, my brother, I'll finish with this. My brother had a friend that came over to visit. He was stationed in Britain for quite a few years. And he brought a fellow home that had a set of bagpipes. And he told me, of course, I tried to play him a little bit. I didn't know what to do. It was kind of fun. He told me that in Britain, the definition of a gentleman is a man that knows how to play the bagpipes, but never does. Well, I understand that because the bagpipes are not an indoor instrument. You know, up in Scotland, they call that noise that the bagpipes make, which is an apt word, they call it the scruel. Of course, they can roll their R's better than I can, me being American. The scruel of the pipes, they call it. Well, what is a gentleman? A gentleman is a man who knows how to be violent, but only does so when it's the right thing to do. And that's a definition that comes from a studied source, by the way, who tried to find the answer to that question, namely my older brother. He said, a gentleman is a man who knows how to be violent in an effective way, but only does so when it's lawfully required. Well, if you want to be a gentleman, taking that definition, that's a pretty good one, by the way. If you want to be a gentleman, that's fulfilling your duty, but you've got to know the law. You can't just go swinging your fist any way you want, being violent any way you want. Is violence part of being a man? It can be. God help us, we hope it isn't necessary. But at the same time, if that duty ever arises, we don't want to misuse it. And that's why we're talking here about the sheriff, we're talking about order, we're talking about duty. Duty only arises from law. How could you possibly know your duty if you don't know the law? Know something about it. Don't know about it. Know it. Soak it. Think about it. Talk about it. This is Brent Allen Winters, CommonLawyer.com. And we're back to Mr. Gerard. And he's looking for his button for his mic. Well, I don't want to stop. No, a dead time on the air is not good business. So while Gerard or somebody...
I'll take it and open it up to open forum.
Oh, okay.
Okay, I'm sure Gerard will be here in a minute.
Yeah, make it.
And if anybody has any questions or comments concerning Brent, feel free to ask him. He's here, and you've got power over your mic, right, Brent?
Yes.
Yeah. So, okay, anybody's got any questions or comments, corrections or anything on the subject matter we looked at tonight, anything Brent brought up or anything we brought up in the past, feel free to ask them. Meanwhile, Gerard, when you get back, just let me know. Okay, we'll take our first individual. It's Jim from PA. You got the mic. Go right ahead.
Yeah, Jim, PA. Gentlemen, I think we're overlooking the authority of a state constable.
To my knowledge, a constable... you know, again, they'd be working for the state, either be appointed by someone. They're not elected positions, so they don't work for the people, so they work for the state. And anybody working for the state ultimately is working under codes and statutes and so on. And, of course, they can also exercise the authority against any faction, you know, any kind of a breaking of the law in the common law, you know. So, but again, they don't. They're not there to protect the people, although they should. They took an oath also, just like anybody else in any of the police forces. They've taken an oath. But when it comes to the people, they can only apply the law, not the statutes, in opposed to applying the statutes towards certain individuals, people who are work for government agencies or commercial activities or that kind of thing. And Gerard, do you want to take back the mic here? I know you were away for a moment. But
yeah,
anyway, that's my answer for that. Maybe Gerard can add to that. And if you got any other thoughts or questions, go right ahead. Okay, you got it, Gerard. I'll pipe in from time to time, I'm sure.
Yeah, there was something about... constable that we discussed a few months back. We had some good information. They're I didn't know they were appointed by the state. I thought they were very, very local, a constable, you know, as far as the job that they do and how they assist the sheriff.
Gerard, I have to jump in on this one.
Yeah, I think they can be local as well as for the state. He was talking about someone that's on the state level, but yeah, they can be local also, because I think in Connecticut, I think they have a constables, if I recall. I know there's some states that have them, but anyway.
Okay.
Go ahead, Jim. What do you know about, you know, the constables and how they become a constable?
Okay, I'm looking at the eligibility for officers in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. The constable can be elected with getting 10 signatures, getting on the ballot, and getting elected by the people. And that is per district. I know there's constables in my borough and the neighboring township. They have constables. Depends on the population. I'm not sure of the breakdown of how many constables, but they are elected. It says here they have to be 18 years old. There's a, you know, get 10 signatures, get on the ballot, get elected, and it's a $10 filing fee. And the term is 6 years. We're overlooking the possibility of a gentleman free man protecting our rights as a constable. So I did read up a little bit.
I wonder if there's a difference in Pennsylvania, because it is a commonwealth. The state of Pennsylvania is considered a commonwealth, and that brings up a couple different things. I'm trying to think. We had a constable when I was a kid, used to run around chase us like Barney Fife. You know what I mean? And I think he was elected. I think you're right. You know, this is New York. So let me see. Hang on. Ron sent me something. I don't know if it's on the constable. I'll read it and see. County Sheriff Department. Hang on. I got to get my glasses because I got a paragraph here that Ron Flick just sent me. Yeah. Let's see the first. Hang on. Oh, this is a lot longer.
Gerard, let me just say, while you're looking, yeah. I believe that these constables have as much authority as a county sheriff. That's what it looks like. I was reading about it. I don't have my information in front of me. I left it in the car. Somebody has it. But I believe that in Pennsylvania, anyways, what I read, I believe they have as much authority. That the only downfall on a constable, they can have deputies, but they have to go to the local judge and get his authority to appoint deputies.
Well, let me read you what Ron has here, because you're right. It sounds like you're right. It says, let's see here. He says, we have a constable post, think district township, for 20 such individuals in our county of 562 square miles and 10,000 people, not a big county. There are roughly 1,500 slots for constables in Arkansas. Only about 50% of the positions are full. Think committee men, and they're about the same in number what they should be. Constable has all the responsibility and authority to the sheriff, except he provides everything out of his own hide, everything, and he's paid zero. It is a two-year commitment. They are the eyes and ears of the sheriff, an extension of what they offer, like deputy in the field, to spread out over the county and assist them. They can work with crime watches with county militia. He can do everything except throw bad guys in jail. That requires him to turn that person over to the sheriff. Back in March 2018, I started a crime watch, which has been a good group, and we met once a month, an average between 12 and 20 in attendance, and then pipe it via cell phone to another 20-plus members in the community. That can't make the meeting for one reason or another. We have 85 in the attached directory out of about 450 on Facebook that our secretary hosts. Since everyone has a cell phone and the phone book is useless, I created the attached directory. Our group spans three districts and two counties. Each meeting will have the sheriff or his deputy or fish and game or special speakers in attendance. the administrative judge from our county makes at least 50% of the meetings, and we get to go to his meetings too. We are now in a third year, and we'll be electing the new president shortly. We have the VP since inception and control the membership data and notifications to everyone, along with other news events, some I sent to you. The first president retired and became township constable for the next 2 years. He has 30 years experience in investigations with Pulaski County Sheriff Department, which is the county where Little Rock sits. He has his name in the ring running for sheriff in Perry County in 2022. This is our county. He has a copy of John's book, as does the existing sheriff, who has been our sheriff for 20 years. The second and current president of the Crime Watch have joined a volunteer fire department and revamped the entire operation down to just one person on life support as of last night, up to 8, and aiming for a staff of 12 to 15. It takes a little work and dedication and active participation. Gerard last month Facebook posted that an elderly man has gone missing. Within 30 minutes, 100 of the community were out looking for him and found him in short order. The sheriff had nothing but praise for the response. The sheriff's department in both counties love us. Well, that's interesting. And also,
you know, I'm looking at Constable here in Black's Law, and it does sound interesting. It sounds like he's somewhat of an assistant to some degree to the sheriff. And I would imagine that if a constable is elected in a certain district or an area within the sheriff's jurisdiction, that he would be need to notify the sheriff of his being, his existence, and be under his wing ultimately. But let me just read what Black says here, constable in American law. An officer of a municipal corporation, usually elected, whose duties are similar to those of the sheriff, though his powers are less and his jurisdiction smaller, he is to preserve the public peace, execute the process of magistrates' courts and of some other tribunals, serve writs, attend the sessions of the criminal courts, have the custody of juries, and discharge other functions sometimes assigned to him by the local law or by the statute. Now, you know, so it does kind of, mesh in with the sheriff's duties, and therefore this person needs to be under the sheriff's authority ultimately. And he does seem to be elected, so that's a good thing. And he does take an oath, of course, so that's a good thing. And so he should be standing up for the people, for the oath, and for the Constitution, and ultimately protect the people from an overreaching government.
And, John, let me mention that I believe that that could work well for NLA to get our people to be constables. Now, the constable elective office requirements is what the county put out here, and it's under the state. Now, the problem is they put it under judicial for some reason with the judges. I don't know why a constable is in with the judges, you know, under their category. But my question would be, I believe, and it's in the information I read about a constable in Pennsylvania, is if he sees the sheriff committing a felony, he can arrest him.
I'd imagine anybody can arrest the sheriff.
Yeah, a citizen's arrest. But you know, in order to do a citizen's arrest, you're supposed to have the sheriff there. It's kind of silly. I think you could bring him to the sheriff. What's a citizen's arrest? I mean, let's expand upon that.
Let me just make one point, though, before you get into that. Just the point that here it says that he is to preserve the public peace, execute the process of magistrates' courts, and of some other tribunals, serve writs, attend the sessions of the criminal courts, have custody of juries. Now, if he has the custody of juries and he is also attending to the sessions of the criminal courts, then he's going to have to be under the authority, ultimately, of the sheriff.
And he's a peace officer.
Work that out. Yeah, and they work that out, I'm sure. So it sounds interesting. It's more help for the sheriff, ultimately, and it's an extension of the sheriff's authority and ability to serve the people. So, and you're in Pennsylvania, so I think that's where I heard that there were constables in Pennsylvania. But I do think I heard something in Connecticut also.
One other thought I wanted to share is, they can carry a sidearm. without getting the permission, the permit, the carry.
I can carry a sidearm without getting the permission or permit too. So, I mean, although that's a problem still, you know, because they
in New York, it's a problem.
Spain is a big problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You carry without the permit. They I don't know what they do to you, but they don't like that.
Well, they shouldn't be able to do anything to you.
Yeah, but it's a felony. That's what Ryan went to jail for.
Right. Well, according to civil law.
Right.
Not
so
common.
That's what I think they go by here.
Well, of course, because in 1938 they moved over to civil law. Common law was done away with. As a matter of fact, they said common law was combined with equity and under one title, civil law. And that's what we're under at this point, is civil law, which is, again, Babylonian law. It leads right back to that, and it controls the people. That's a violation to our Constitution. It's ultimately treason. And the Bar Association is the ones that push this forward, but not just this. Many, many, many things that they push forward. That whole association has to be, disarmed or dispersed ultimately. It needs to be broken up. And I think people should go to jail that are teaching our lawyers that were under civil law, not common law. And, you know, when you talk to a lawyer and you talk to them about common law, and some of them will say, yeah, well, there still is some common law, and they call that precedence. They call that the precedence of the court's decisions, and they call that common law. Again, they're taught a couple of things in bar schools, bar taught schools, but nothing proper, nothing on what is the truth concerning common law.
Okay, John, the other thought was, now I understand probably why, from our discussion here, why this constable is listed under the judicial. They probably work for the judges directly. And the other thing, I believe that they don't work for the sheriff. I think they are independent.
Well, again, they're taking up some of the authority of the sheriff, and that is encroaching upon the sheriff's duty. Ultimately, he's the chief law enforcer of the county. There's nobody higher than him, so clearly the sheriff is above the constable. And if the constable is doing something, something that is wrong or not informing, look at. The sheriff is responsible for what goes on the courts. The sheriff is responsible ultimately to have a duty.
And that's
to
why
have
they
his deputies.
The executive department too, which is
right.
a mistake of their thinking as far as his authority.
Or we call them bailiffs too, because they're also part of the deputy system.
Right.
But they're working in the courts, and they're under the wing and the authority of the sheriff. So if a constable is in the court, he's got to report to. That whole system's got to report to the sheriff that they got that this is covered here, and there's certain criterias and requirements and rules that you would imagine the sheriff would apply upon them, just like he would apply upon any deputy. So it can get confusing. I think once the law is returned to the people, a lot of these courts that are, all these administrative courts, town courts, city courts, village courts, all those courts, they've got to be shut down. I mean, ultimately, unless they think they can survive on the tickets that they give to commercial activities, but they're certainly not going to be able to, gain their monies from the people. So they're not going to have the money to be able to afford a lot of these, police forces. That's going to widen the necessity and the burden over the sheriff, which means the sheriff's office got to grow more. State and local monies, county monies, which ultimately comes from the state anyway, but county monies or state monies have to be, put forward into the sheriff more than what they're getting now in order to bring on more assistance to be able to uphold the law. But on the other hand, nowhere near as much police forcing that they have throughout our nation and maybe, town, village, and city and so on and so forth, because most of those police officers are enforcing civil law, and sheriffs are not supposed to enforce civil law. They can write a ticket, but only for violations in commercial activities. Yeah, they can stop someone that's driving drunk. I mean, that's their duty. It's a danger to society, to the people. They can, if someone's driving recklessly and they put people in danger, yeah, they have a duty to do something. I mean, that's just common sense. But not applying anything upon that person or people by any codes. again, unless it's a commercial vehicle, then of course codes are applied upon them.
Okay, John, I'm going to close with this last remark. I believe until we get to the other side, which we always talk about, till we get to the other side, which we haven't gotten there yet, I think we need to use the state constables to help us get to the other side. I think we can use them to NLA's favor.
Well, I would agree to you if we can get the attention of constables and get them to learn what we're learning and applying the real law and exercising their duties only under the real law. And again, a constable, I would imagine, can also violate someone under equity in commercial activity. Again, go back to that. But yeah, I would think, look at anybody that can help the sheriff and the system, you know, should be, you know. And again, part of coming together as a committee of safety is also restructuring the militia within that county and county to county. When you have a certain amount of counties together and a certain number of people spread through a certain proportion of the state, that's when that militia can come under the authority of the governor. And they can become become the more organized militia. And then, however all that works, I would really refer to Brent on that. He's got a lot more knowledge on how all that works. But nevertheless, you know, just we as the people in the committees of safety having that connection with the sheriff, encouraging the sheriff or one of the sheriff's deputies or someone attending our meetings, and having that close relationship also becomes a place where a list is made out of people who can assist the sheriff if he were to call forth the posse comitatus, you know. Then, of course, and the sheriff's got that connection, people he knows, people he understands, people who can handle a weapon, and people he can trust with the authority that he might have to impose upon them in an emergency. So, you know, he doesn't necessarily need that police force then. He's got the people. You know, so when something big happens, an emergency, he can pull that together. And it's the Committee of Safety, which is that connection and security and also confidence of the sheriff to the people that he's dealing with at this point, because he knows them. He's participating with them. He sees what they're all about, their beliefs, their thoughts, understanding the Constitution. They have to protect the people and to uphold the law. It's the real citizens that are doing their duty. So all of that, it works together. And anybody that can participate with that, you know, you got the fire department also, you got the emergency or other emergency services, ambulances and rescue, and you got the constables, like you say, the state police. I mean, you know, again, you have a small army, really, in every county, and especially when you can use the people, you have something really quick you can pull together.
You know, Ron makes a good point here that there are so many slots and only, like, in the one state there, only 50% of them are filled. And it's kind of like the committee men. I mean, why are not all the committee men positions filled? And there's probably lots of reasons for that. One of which I could imagine is because they've taken a lot of their authority away and they don't have the authority that they're supposed to, and so people aren't interested. Now, as far
also because they can't get them. Okay, they can't get enough. But, you know, bear in mind, if that was the case, and they were really hungry for people, then the people who are coming in, you know, contrary to their thinking, you know, like we did, not going through the system, kissing the ring of the party boss, that kind of thing, then at that point, of course, they don't want us there. Whenever anybody runs for a particular position or something, and if that position is filled, they just shuffle them over to another place. They do that all the time. Why won't they do that with us? Because we know we're pushing the Constitution, and really that pushing that authority really starts to take power away from them and what they offer to the committeemen, because a lot of these committeemen that really get involved and really support what the party is doing and all that stuff, they're getting kickbacks. They're getting, maybe it's a guy who owns owns a service where maybe a towing service, and he's going to get the contract on that part of the highway that runs through that county or whatever. I mean, it's all about that. At least that's what I see, that kind of thing all the time.
The other thing is, since he's not paid and since he provides everything himself, there's a question of liability. Does he provide his own insurance in case somebody wants to sue him? And that would be a deterrent to anybody wanting to run that position, because you're taking on an awful lot of liability on your own. You know, I could see where it would be better if he's under the sheriff and under the county in that respect, you know, because some of the liability is covered under those offices. But I mean, if I got to provide all my own stuff, my own gun and this and that, and I'd have to apply, I'd have to carry my own liability insurance if they would even give it to you. I bet you the insurance companies will not even insure you, you know. I mean, that's a problem with the sheriff. They tell them, if you don't get covered under this plan, you can't be sheriff. You know, they hold insurance over their head too. Oh no, you have to go under this certain insurance, or you're not going to have the authority. We're not going to recognize you. Blah blah blah. I know that insurance is an issue. So anyway, it's interesting. I don't know. Look, it's we the people. I think we can do whatever we want. You know what I mean? And we can bend the definitions this way or that, as long as they stay constitutional. And look, it looks like this county here that Ron is in, they're using them very well. You know, they're using them almost like a militia, right? You know, they're coming out looking for missing people and stuff like that. Sounds like they're more like a, you know, they're as much a first responder as a fireman is, you know? And actually, this just brings my juices are going now. The fire department has fire police that are peace officers, and they can carry a gun. Not many of them do, but I know in the way that the statute or the law is written, the fire police is a peace officer. And when you're a peace officer, that gives you a certain amount of authority. And I think you fall under the town's insurance. I think they have to insure you under that local municipality. Anyway, it's bears looking into anyway. It's an interesting subject. Like I said, the only thing I knew about a constable was we had like a Barney Fife that used to chase us all over the place. And this guy was always quoting us the statutes or the law, you know, and it was pretty funny. I wish I could have filmed a couple of our encounters. He used to chase my brother and I around when we were kids for illegally announce, you know, my brother hooked up a big speaker and he was on there yelling stuff across the valley, and the constable come out, "You can't, that's an illegal broadcast." He's jumping up and down, you know, and it was funny because my brother's upstairs, he's got the speaker out the window, and the constable's like, "Who's that? Who's that?" And I'm telling my brother, shut up, the constable's here. His name was Fracker. He didn't believe me. He's going, "Fricky, Fracky, Fracker, Fracky." And the guy standing up next to me jumping up and down. He went up the stairs of the bedroom, grabbed the speaker and the thing my brother hooked up to a tape recorder, and confiscated it. I mean, I don't know how legal that was, but that was my experience with the constable, always, you know, getting into stupid stuff like that with him. But very local, you know. So I think we beat that subject up, so thank you, Jim.
Well, Gerard, I really believe that NOA should have at least a web mention of the constable and do some research and post it, because I think the constable at this point is the solution to getting to the other side, or one of the steps to getting to the other side. The sheriff is I don't think it's working that well. I know the sheriff right now. Well, he's going to be there till January, but the sheriff of our county, he's as government guy as can be. You know, a former officer in the Pittsburgh City Police. You know, he's not going to come around. He's never going to come to understand what we have to tell him. Matter of fact, he asked me to leave his office when I brought up some things that he couldn't deal with. But I would urge NOA to. I haven't researched it enough, but the insurance could be a problem. But the municipality may have to pay for it also. I'm not sure, but they may have been downplaying this all these years, the powers that be. But I think we, the people, should become constables, because a lot of those seats or those openings are available for for anybody to jump in and become a con, and I think it's a state constable. And it's very easy. Get 10 signatures, get your name on the ballot, get the signature, and then you're an elected official. You're elected peace officer then. So,
well, you could definitely be a thorn in your in a bad sheriff's side, because, you know, anytime, look at anybody that sees a crime or wants to get involved and do an affidavit, that's the basis of all law. You know, so I could see by having this guy there, and maybe you got a sheriff that doesn't want to get involved or whatever, doesn't want to do his job. Certainly, if there was a constable there that somebody can come and complain to, and he could move that complaint through the system where the sheriff might not want to, you know, or it might force the sheriff into the fray, so to speak, you know.
I think an elected constable will be respected in the courts and in the community. I think that's the way to go. If we get enough of the Brent was saying, the gentleman freeman, you got to be a freeman and a gentleman. You get those kind of people to be constables, and then they'll do the right thing.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at their duties, it does command a certain respect. I think they can even perform civil marriages and things like that, like a judge would, you know?
Yeah, I didn't read anything about that in the. I wish I had that paper. I left it in my car, but I really think this could be very helpful to our cause if we just pursue it and find out more and educate the people. I yield.
Okay. That's your homework. That's your homework.
Okay. My joke is I do that in my spare time.
Yeah, right.
A joke in my spare time. Good night.
Yeah. All right. Let's go to the next one, which is Ross.
I went to a meeting on this last Thursday called the Liberty Coalition, and one of the guys who speaks said we need to infiltrate the public administration to get control back over the administrative state.
What was that, infiltrate the I didn't hear, the public what?
The public administration means the government agencies and that.
Well, how do you infiltrate them? I mean, some of these are elected offices, right?
So some of them are actually, you know, when you go to like the US .gov job site
for .gov,
job.gov. That's hired servants, means people who actually sign an application to work for the federal government itself, not actually run for office or appointed positions.
Mm-hmm.
That's so what he...
These are administrative positions, is what you're saying.
Yes, yes.
Right, so in other words, they can be... I assume they're appointed positions then.
Yes.
For the most part.
Yeah, most part. So you hold a general schedule for government employees?
Mm-hmm.
The general schedule?
Well, it's a thought to get people's fingers in the system, I suppose. I think that's probably what he's thinking, that he's getting more regular people and not such career politicians into these positions, you know, and you know, the biggest thing I think that beat us over the head is with administrative law and administrative things. But a lot of what they do is administrative, which is not necessarily constitutional. You know what I mean?
Nope.
Administrative, the way that you get yourself tied up in that is that you use their services. There's like a contract there. It's like you enter into a contract, and that's why you get sucked into an administrative court. Like, I'm a licensed repair shop, so when something comes down, they have their own court system. They got an administrative court. Same thing with DEC. They don't use the regular courts. they use retired judges and that, and they hire these guys and pay them to be administrators, and they do all kinds of stuff. But I think ultimately, if you're not happy with them, you can bring it into the regular court system through the due process. They have to give you your due process. If you don't like the way an administrative hearing turned out, it's going to end up between in front of an elected judge. I do believe that that's your final recourse. I'm pretty sure that, you know, John has had some stuff with, like, employment, I mean, the administration of you know, the employment department, and it's all by contract. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, and sometimes they try to get you sucked in even though you didn't contract, but by answering them and engaging with them, what happens is you end up giving them a certain authority over you, because it is nothing more than administrative law. So look, we could use it to our advantage in that respect. I understand that, you know, two can play that game. And I suppose if we know about it and we get into these administrative positions, we could bring some, you know, sanity to them, let's say, you know.
So how about, like, if you want to be the Secretary of State of the United States and that kind of position?
Well, I don't know that that's available at that level. Do you? That's something you'd have to look into.
No, actually, it's more like you have to be asked by the President-elect to be. Did he have to ask you?
You're talking about national, like you have to have the President of the United States appoint you?
Yes. So they do have regular employees in the federal government itself. Like, say, the Land Bureau of Management, they have land law examiners.
Okay.
Means if you want to apply for a land patent, you have to have all the proof of paperwork. You have a chain of custody over the land you own. You see, that's why it's so complicated in the Land Bureau Management.
Yeah, it sounds very administrative to me. You know what I mean?
Yes, that
it
is.
They're writing their own statutes and they're enforcing them. And I mean, that could turn into a can of worms, and it's certainly open to political abuse. You know, I could see them putting their buddies in there. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So
I don't know
if they let you or me in there, but it's an interesting conversation.
Yes. Yeah. I was talking about land patents. That's also a different can of worms. So that's because the land patents are governed by treaty, land treaties.
Right.
Too. And that's a whole different level of...
Oh, yeah. We lost Robert Overyeal, who was an expert in land patents. It's unfortunate because he knew everything about them, you know, as far as... how to research them and how to perfect them and all that stuff. It's too bad he took a lot of that knowledge with him when he died. But anyway.
I guess people have to learn themselves. I've read books about a lordial title and that.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, you know, we should all have a lordial title. Never mind this tenant on the land baloney. You know, when the king bequeathed that land over, there was very few. Usually, he gave the allodial title. There were certain treaties and things like that that had things in them that gave back to the king or gave authority to, because there was something about taxes or something like that that they could tax. They still had a certain control over them. But with a lordial title, that was giving you title fee simple, flea and clear. That was your property. You owned it, and nobody could tell you what to do with it, not even the king. He actually, you know, that's why it's important to have a lordial title. That's like full ownership. That's your sovereign, you know, right and sovereign ownership. And
so
really...
Yeah, if the person who owns the land deed, that's not for ownership.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, the way they write it, and they don't look at if you don't own your land really the way things are in America, because if you owned it, they wouldn't be able to tax you on it.
Yes.
The fact that they can tax you means they can take it away from you, which means that you're just a tenant. You're just renting it. And they even your land deed a lot of times says tenant on the land.
Yeah.
You know? So they're not treating you like you have a loyal title. Nobody questions this stuff. We just go through the motions for years and years and years. And then at some point they decide that, you know, because you were late on your taxes or whatever, they do this in rem thing and they convert the deed over and you lose the property. They put it in the name of the town, and then they kick you off with the sheriff. They go down and file like you're a scofflaw tenant. I mean, you want to talk about injustice and dictatorship? The whole tax system with their in rem foreclosures is a subject that is near and dear to my heart. Believe me. Because we've been fighting them for years, trying to figure out how to get our land out from under their clutches, and it is an issue, and it's something we probably should keep pursuing. Because look at, if you can't own private property, because that's what they have to change the definition on your property to private, they can't tax it if it's private. You see, and if you can't own property, you're not free. You know, your first piece of property is your body, and that's becoming very much more evident. These are going to be issues that are going to come up here in the near future. This whole vaccination thing, and your body, and the first people, and you know, in order to have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, you have to be able to own land. Because how could you exercise your sovereign rights if you don't have a place to do it? I mean, I could rent to you, and I could say, no pets, no this, lights, I got to be out by 10 o'clock. Well, you're not free, you're not sovereign then, you're not king on that property, right? If I could put stipulations on you and enforce them. So this whole business needs to be straightened out, you know? I mean, years ago, if you weren't a landowner, you didn't get to vote in a local election because the landowners were paying the taxes. And that sort of makes more sense than it does today, you know. At least you're getting taxation with representation that way, right? Mm-hmm. But now everybody votes, and then they come out and they put in these what do you call them bills and stuff to spend money, and everybody votes on them. But the landowners, who's paying for it? Because they raise his taxes to pay for it when they have these referendums that they have the people vote on. Well, people that are renting should not be able to vote on that, you know, yes. Because the landowner is the one that's footing the bill.
So yes, I feel like that's what the community states they have to fix ourselves. Because
mm-hmm.
If we want the Constitution to work, we have to restore the land situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's kind of what we're doing and what we're about. So these are things that are going to become issues, and we need to get back to, you know, common law, the way things used to be. And then,
okay.
And then things will be better, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If they revert everything back to common law, a lot of these problems would fix themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because it would be understood if you got a deed and a property that you own that property. And
mm-hmm.
I don't know how they'll fix it, you know, because you got a lot of lawyers' tentacles in there. You know, they're always thinking of ways that they can muck up the works, but they have to get their fingers out of this and hand it back over to the people.
The problem is also, it's all about the color of law, too. They use that.
Yeah, the color of law, yeah.
Yeah, they call it the color of title, basically.
Color
yeah,
of title.
Pin. Yeah.
Well, when you come over here and tax my land and tell me when I got to do this and that, your color's clashing with me, you know what I mean?
Yes.
Anyway, another good subject, right?
Yes.
Between you know, all this administrative stuff and constables, and we're really kicking up the pot here tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you, Ross. I'm going to move ahead before I run out of time and getting down to the wire here.
Okay.
Anyway, it's always good. Thank you. I'm going to move to, looks like Brian from Oregon. You're next.
Hello, Gerard. This is Brian, Oregon.
Yeah.
Good evening.
Good evening.
It's been a good one. It's been a good one. Did you get the email that I sent in the questions?
I didn't see it. I mean, I get a copy of them, but I didn't get a chance to look at it before the show. What was it? Refresh my...
Oh, okay. I see. Well, essentially, it wasn't before the show. I apologize. It was actually during the show, so not your fault by any means. Essentially, what I'm dealing with is a foreclosure that was found to be unlawful, a non-judicial foreclosure, where I have two actual actions, and one of them is a common law grand jury joinder, which has gone all the way through to the decision and order. So it was show cause, denial jurisdiction, move for cause, action at law, and then the final decision and order. And all of those elements, those instruments are filed into the county record and the court record for that foreclosure case. And then I also did along the same lines in parallel from some of the common law grand jury and NLA document stuff, the actual affidavit of default judgment. And so the show cause, denial jurisdiction, and then pressed forward with the appropriate timing and duly operated documents, where then I did get an actual affidavit default judgment in my favor, essentially, because they didn't respond, of course, as we know.
And you filed that with the county clerk?
Yes, I filed it with the county clerk.
And did you get any trouble at all? That's a victory, by the way, if that happened.
I agree. Both. Well, see, here's the great victory is that, yeah, I won, but they're still
no,
running me
well,
through the
court. So you won, so what are you going to do about it? There are companies that collect those kind of debts. Matter of fact, one of them approached John, and we used to work with the guy, I forget his name, but that's what he did. He'd go out and find these things, and he would exercise them.
Beautiful. I'd love to get in contact with somebody.
I do believe it's exercised through the sheriff.
Judy Ayer?
I think they can give the summons or whatever, you know what I mean? So I don't know what you put down for your damages or whatever, but it is exercisable, and so you have to get somebody that knows how to run these liens and stuff. They're basically
correct.
Like to collect on them. There's companies out there that do it. As a matter of fact, we used to carry the guy's ad on the sidebar of NLA. That was what his thing was. I don't know if we do it, if we are promoting him anymore or what happened with
okay.
that.
I'll have to look through it. I have done some work with Jim and Terry and Carl and such on the NLA projects.
Right.
Which was nice. I wish I had plenty more time to do that. So once I get this resolved, then that'll come around.
But there are collection agencies and guys that run around and collect those judgments. That's a judgment that you got. You got a default judgment. So what happens is, you know, there's another step. I don't know what the next step is, but like you can put a lien on the property. There's lots of different ways of collecting a judgment like that, you know.
Right, exactly. So yes, that's more a little on the longer term stuff, which I agree 100%. The situation that we're kind of faced with right now is that so that you can understand and to clarify, I have that affidavit of default judgment done and filed and certified, if not exemplified copies in the court record of the non-judicial foreclosure. But along with that, in parallel, I did the entire joinder process through with the common law grand jury, and even have that decision and order completely done which thank you, Common Law Grand Jury, very much, that was filed into the Northern District of New York. And so it was moved for cause, decision and order filed in the district court there in New York. And then that was, here's the interesting part, and you'll enjoy this, that the district court, Northern District of New York, filed that case with their own cover letter, with me as plaintiff, D&O on there, in back into that same case file back in my local circuit court.
So did they foreclose on your property?
Yes, and now they have foreclosed on the property. They've pursued, so
that's
I have
a
two
lawsuit.
Other.
They got to give it back.
Right. So essentially,
if you got a judgment due to default because they didn't answer, they're breaking the law. That's your property.
Toast, I know. Yeah. And so right now, what's actually happening is
that the sheriff to come in and arrest them.
The sheriff won't do anything about it. And I've even given them the order. I've talked to them. I called and talked to them today.
He's a coward.
And the problem is, pardon?
He's a coward.
Right. Well, it's unfortunate. And I've been very clear in what's going on. And the problem is that
the
bank changed the title. Right, right. So there's definitely a suit and move for cause. But the key point is that the bank itself, after all of this action, decision and order, affidavit, all that, went in and changed the title from my name to their name. And then
that's
sold
what they
the
do.
Property.
That's what they do.
Yeah. And then they sold the property with a special warranty deed, so not a true warranty deed. It's only a special warranty deed, which only covers the prior seller, not the transfer, not me. So the new folks that think that they own my property then trespassed on my land for about an hour and a half when I wasn't home, walking around with a video camera, like watching the road and back and forth through all my private stuff, including escorting an unknown male onto my land who also wandered around with his video camera. So that's absolute violation of Amendment 4. And ultimately what is happening is that they are having the Nisi Prius just push it through the court, court of equity style eviction, where they didn't even give us even hardly 2 weeks to even consider, get documents filed, exhibits, anything at all. And so they're just slamming everything through. And what I'm actually afraid of, and other occupants here at the house, is that we're going to end up with a sheriff here tomorrow and from the unlawful foreclosure and eviction and that entire process. So ultimately, here's the big question, right? Drum roll, please. Is at this point, is this where we would contact a federal marshal to take action? Because these instruments were moved. Everything was moved. These causes of action were moved to the federal level and through the court of record. Both of them had jurisdiction, court of record, under the rules of common law. Across the top, right?
Very interesting. Yes, very interesting.
Yeah. So the question is this an action for the federal marshal?
I don't know if the federal marshal would take it on, but possibly. And that sheriff is opening himself to liability by enforcing this when you have an action that's been, it's not even pending. It's basically been done.
Right, and it's filed in that case, and I've been very clear about that, and the affidavit of default judgment was done the day before they sold the house, and I hand-delivered it to the civil department sheriff deputy and let him know, you know, that you need to stop and abate at law. Here's a default judgment that says abate and release interest.
You know what you need to give him? You need to give him a notice of liability.
Okay.
You know what I mean? I don't know if you know that much about notices of liability. That was something that the In Power group was doing on public opinion.
Okay.
And
I'm not familiar.
And what happens is it holds him personally responsible because he's misusing his office.
Right. Okay.
So I don't know who to turn you to as far as notice of liability. What was the name of that group that was... It was trying to get the meters off the houses, the smart meters, and he was using notices of cow, whatever. We unfortunately we lost touch with them. I don't know how they're doing, but he had some very good successes in court. You know, filing paperwork, much like what you're talking about. We should have teamed up with them because they were pretty good what they were doing with their paperwork. I think they were coming to us looking for enforcement, though. They would get so far, just like you did, and they didn't know how to enforce it, who to go to next. And we were
right. And the only thing I can do is just file more paperwork.
Well, yeah, but, you know, you got to file something that'll shake them up, like a notice of liability, you know. You owe me $50 million for, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I literally even, so in the preliminary trial, unfortunately, one of the judges was one of the judges in the action of the foreclosure in the first place. And so in that, I clearly specified to her that I was not joining in with them and that I was there on special appearance, as you know from the documents, on special appearance to test the sufficiency of service process and jurisdiction. And her response was, I have no idea what you're talking about. Anyway, we will continue. And so then when she just cut me off, wouldn't even allow me to keep talking or anything. And so then I finally got in there and I asked her directly, I said, is this a court of record? And her response was double affirmative, yes, it is. And my point was, I do not consent. If you're saying this is a court of record and you're holding me under statutory elements, then I don't consent. There's no due process. You haven't shown me the proper process.
This is in New York?
And you haven't shown me jurisdiction. This is in Oregon.
Oh, Oregon.
Right?
Hmm.
So, yeah, it's kind of ugly. Bit of concern.
I mean, you've taken a couple of points, and they didn't catch you, and they file that paperwork. I see over here in New York, the clerks are unwilling to let that thing go forward because I think they've been
right.
told. You know,
yeah, so, I also filed at times the file on demand paper you guys created.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I did put that in the very beginning
sometimes
as well.
That's
with
why they file it, because they're scared of that.
Right. Yeah, they put a big question mark. Like,
am I really going to get in trouble if I don't do this?
yeah. And so what we wrap back around to, and this seems to be just, you know, really the common point that would, like, purvey across everything, is the USC Title 18, 241 and 242 are the different portions which describe, as we talked about earlier, or was heard earlier, conspiracy and color of law. So that's the place to go, is Title 18, USC Title 18, 241, 242,
so,
which is in the joinder docs, too.
Let me ask you something that wasn't clear in the beginning of this. Is this a bank foreclosure?
Essentially, it was a bank foreclosure, non-judicial foreclosure that went through the civil court. And then now what is occurring is the new, quote, alleged owner is essentially doing a high-speed eviction. So it's, you know, just there's,
yeah,
there's
well,
not...
They already converted the deed. That's how they did that. By the illegal conversion of the deed, they're treating you
right.
like a off-law tenant. I understand that. That's the
right.
baloney that New York uses with their in-rim, you know, foreclosure, so to speak. So very interesting. You've got a couple of things going on there that they should be worried about. And I would use that notice of liability to inform everybody that touched it that they're liable.
Right, right.
I don't know if we have any of that documentation on our site, but that In Power Group had documentation on the notices of liability that they used. You could copy that and use their format, I would think. But I would get them off, you know, pronto, because... You know, they're going to come kick you off, and there's not much. They'll be putting you in handcuffs and throwing you in jail, you know?
Pretty close. I've been on the property for over 10 years, so it's not like I can move in a day.
Right.
That's not happening at all. I have multiple trucks, trailers, well, equipment.
I wish I could tell you more, but I think the notice of liability is pretty powerful because it holds them personally responsible. You know, these people, they don't have trouble bleeding you when it doesn't cost them anything. The minute they think it's going to cost them something, then they get a different attitude. So I would try to file something like that to maybe deter them, you know, and you know, figure out what your next step's going to be. And, you know, at the same time, see if you can get a federal marshal involved. You know, I mean, they're not going to get involved if they don't think that they have jurisdiction. But maybe they do have jurisdiction, and you're going to have to, like, show them that they do and convince them that this is, you know, this is a good case because at least I think it was Thornton said, he said, you know, these different courts are jealous of their power. And so when you move something out of a state court to a federal court, a lot of times those officials, a federal marshal included, want to flex their muscles a little bit to protect their jurisdiction, so to speak. See, they can't, if they're not exercising or doing anything, then they're going to lose their jurisdiction if they never exercise it, right? So a lot of times those judges are more than happy to slap the lower judges, you know.
Yeah.
And I think the same thing goes through with the marshal in that. So I would pursue all that stuff at the same time and see what, you know, throw a bunch of stuff on the wall, see what sticks.
Yeah, that's the plan, is just keep on pumping it into the file. And considering, as you were saying, with the federal marshal and wanting to reserve their jurisdiction and zone, the interesting thing was that between multiple sheriffs, secretaries, clerks, the judges, you name it, not one was actually able to identify the jurisdiction.
Yeah, they don't even know what you're talking about.
They had no idea. Yeah. Oh, this is a landlord-tenant case. Well, what jurisdiction is that?
Yeah.
Is it a court of record? Yeah, we record everything.
they don't know what court of record is, but that's okay.
Yep. Okay, well,
anyway,
I appreciate
that. That really gives another interesting twist on tonight's call. Boy, we're really knocking them dead here with these outside the box cases, so to speak. Like, that's what we are. That's what an LA is, outside the box, so to speak.
Oh yeah. Well, you guys have helped me immensely. So I've run through various other, you know, spaces and worked on my own education and such just to keep my stuff moving. But I've definitely found a good space.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Well, I'm glad that you're doing as well as you're. I mean, it might not look like you're doing well right now, but I think you're in a pretty dang good position, to be honest with you.
Well, in the long run, you know,
the bigger part is, just don't try to get yourself not thrown in jail, because that doesn't serve anybody any good.
I already have my bailout, buddy, so I'm good.
Yeah, okay. Good, good proactive thinking there. At least you're not being presumptuous, right? Anyway, keep us posted on this, too. This is interesting, because what you have is kind of sort of a test case for NLA.
They got
pushed all the way through, and you got all this paperwork filed, and they accepted it, and that's a dream come true. I don't know if you realize that.
Exactly. I do, and I appreciate it. Again, it's thanks to you guys and just keeping the ball moving. And here's actually a parallel element, is that I can prove where the courts have been manipulating the docket. So, as I said, I had my affidavit of default judgment filed into the case, stamped, right, from the courthouse for the date of September 11th, actually, is what it was, and they sold the house on September 12th. Yet when they show in the file, and so I have stamped affidavit default judgment from the court for the 11th, but yet they show that it's entered in the docket on the 12th after the sale. Yep. And I have both that copy and prior copies of earlier screenshots. So definitely, if this would be the best advice I can give, is if you're running through your own court docket, take screenshots, 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 do the entire thing, print it out, do it over and over, because they change it constantly.
Wow.
Yeah. So
that's interesting. Well, you would think there, you would think that there's an aggressive lawyer out there, hungry lawyer, that would love to run with this.
Because I wish. I just haven't had time. I haven't had time to call anybody.
Multiple levels.
Yeah. Right. In several directions and levels. Agreed.
Yeah.
So, just out of curiosity, and I had sent a letter to Laura there that's in the Court Observer. Mm-hmm. She's the coordinator for Court Observer. I'm not familiar with her, but I sent her an email. And I would be very grateful if I could get any court observers in on my trial, which is tomorrow at 1:30. I know it's a very short notice, but as you can hear, it's a different one. So I did email the information is in questions at NLA, so it's in there, and it has the phone numbers to call in.
A number where you could actually call her?
I don't have her number. I only had an email. So my contact information is in NLA, and I actually put in a new application for membership. I've been paying my dues even though I wasn't a member anymore, but not your fault. I thought I was being hacked, so I just pulled from your site so I wouldn't be affecting you guys.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so I recently entered a new request for membership and haven't heard back. I know you guys are busy. All good. But Jim, Terry, and Carl have my info.
So maybe we could look up this Laura and maybe get a phone number that you could actually talk to her. I mean, like you said, it's a short notice, but if you got somebody local.
Yeah.
And it doesn't even have, anybody can be a court observer for you. So if you can get somebody to come in and sit there and take notes, and then when they're done, the most important thing is that they fill out an affidavit, get it notarized, you know, a sworn statement.
You bet. Okay. Right.
I highly recommend that, because those things are powerful. They hate them because they are so powerful, and they just want to ignore them, but they can't, you know.
Yeah, true.
So get somebody to sit there and then just let them, you know, write an affidavit when they're done and have it, you know, have it sworn, notarized and sworn. And that's also you put in the packet of your paperwork. I think
right.
It makes things much more powerful when you do that, you know.
Padding the docket, filling it up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Brian. We appreciate it.
Gerard.
Yeah. So I'm going to move to Drew from PA, and he's the last one. Go ahead, Drew.
Hi, John. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
All right. I am a constable in Pennsylvania. I talked to you last few years. If you remember, I was trying to get you to get constables on board. Constables are elected and elected to the executive branch, although they do the judicial work.
It's kind of similar to what the sheriff is then.
I believe so. I believe for a long time that the constables have some authority. The regular police aren't really thrilled with constables. I became a constable because I was in a Ron Paul Campaign for Liberty group, and me and several friends became constables in the area, in the two joining counties here.
So what's the term on that over there? Is it 2 years or what?
Six years.
6 years. Oh, that's nice. You don't have to worry about getting reinstated for 6 years. That's a pretty nice term.
I've been constable for 6 years. I just ran a writing campaign, too, because I wasn't on the ballot, and I lost that to another guy, but it's okay. I have other plans, you know, other plans to get in, because I fought with my township, and that's why I became constable in the first place, and the thing is they couldn't make me do anything. You know, my friend, the constable, says they can make you do anything. You're a state. You know, you're a state. And they can't. They really can't. They say that you're only answerable to the governor. I've already fought with the sheriff in the county court, you know, on things. I've already been to the court with the police several times because, you know, the police try to violate rights. They pull you over. They don't know you're a constable. They do things, and you say, hey, you know, you're violating rights. You go to court. And they kind of are surprised that they find out I'm a constable. It's, I call myself a constitutional constable or a common law constable. They don't know what to do. They're like confused.
I love it.
The only person that does that. But I really do say constables because there's so many in different areas, you know, different cities that in my area is a township, so I was the only one. But in the city near where I live there and I work, you know, there's 20 of them. So, you know, they are, I believe they do have somewhat sheriff, you know, abilities. They can't do traffic. You know, they're not allowed to do traffic, but they can. Really what they want you to do is they want you to be collectors for the courts. You know,
right.
When I was in training at the college, the state pays for your training. I went through the training at the college, and I used to question them all the time. And I'd ask them, what is a constable's authority of arrest? You know, what is their authority as far as arrest? And they don't want to answer you because they only want you to arrest based on a warrant from the court for citations and things like that, you know. They really want you to work for the courts, but you don't have to work for the courts. They can't make you work for a court. Also, a constable is supposed to be able to carry in all 50 states for life.
Okay.
And that's very interesting. Yeah. And when I was in school, the one girl there was a constable. I'm like, why do you want to be a constable? She said, I only came here, she said, because I want to be able to carry in 50 states for life. And I thought
that's a good incentive, yes.
Yeah, that was her reasoning. She's a friend of mine now, and she's, you know, she deputized her husband now, because you could deputize, you know, your own deputies, and also you buy your own equipment. And there has been a constable in Pennsylvania that has been in trouble because he ordered like 20 Crown Victoria. He was putting together his own police force. And I don't know how they could stop you because you're allowed to do that. You know, you could buy your own police car, you could have your own equipment, whatever. It's up to you.
Very interesting.
Yeah, constables began in 1664. I guess they came from like the king's stables, you know. And
right.
You know, and there was the first police in Pennsylvania. There was the first police killed in Pennsylvania. And they really don't like you to call yourself police, although it says, you know, you they are a peace officer. But they do have the ability to arrest without warrant, and most constables don't even know that.
Wow. You know, I think the constabulary is more popular in England.
Well, the constables were in England, yes. That's where they originated from the King's Stables. Yes, absolutely. Another thing is, you know, there's been a constable in New York there who was carrying, and he did some construction work in New York. I mean, there's a constable. He was carrying, and I guess he got arrested or something happened there in New York because he was carrying, and he beat that case because he had a right to carry. And,
wow.
You know,
that's very interesting.
Yeah, like I talked to you before about it, I was trying to get you on board a couple of years ago about getting constables kind of rounded up on the NLA side because I think you would be able to do that. There's a lot of constables that are, you know, in the Constitution and all that kind of stuff, so, you know, libertarian constables and things like that.
Well, I think it's more pertinent now than it ever was, you know.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, I have meetings with constables, and I try to even tell the constables all the time that their duties are further than they think. You know, they think they can only work for the courts. It's not true, because I don't work for the courts. I think the courts violate people's rights. I won't work for the courts.
Well, that's what they try to do with the sheriffs. They think the sheriff is just a paperboy for the court.
Well, that's it, and that's exactly, yeah, and he's exactly, they don't know the duties or their powers either. You know, the constable's number one duty is to be at the election, so, you know, the polls. That is their real number one duty. After that, you know, everything else is pretty much what they want. You could work for any court you want in the state. You know, you could work privately. You know, you could work privately. As a matter of fact, me and the friend constable, we just worked for an insurance company where they were stealing millions of dollars. Not an insurance company, a loan company. You know, the CEO was stealing millions of dollars, and we wanted constables to secure the place for a while. And at $40 an hour, that was pretty good money.
Well,
things like that. You know, but. You could serve, you could process serve, you know, you don't have to go through the courts for that, you could process serve. But there is, they don't like to let them know the powers. Like I said, I've been pulled over and, you know, for no reason whatsoever, and cops are fighting with me over stuff, or searching the car and everything, and I'd like, hey, you know. And, you know, then the one cop's telling me, well, prove you own the car. I said, I just gave your partner there the registration. He says, oh, that's an owner's car. I said, well, there you go. I said, that's me on there, and that's who owns the car. And he's like, well, can you prove that? I said, where, in the parking lot right now or in court? And he just looked at me like, oh, my God. And he went to court. Every time I go to court, I'm with him. Every time I go to court with them, I either beat them or they gets thrown out before it gets started.
Right.
Yeah.
That's good. Thing. I love it.
I think there is something there, and there's a Pennsylvania Constable Association. I don't know, but I think constables are in all the states. I'm not sure really.
I think you're probably right. They've suppressed them so why, you know, they don't want to.
They do suppress them. Yeah, they don't let people know. Like, you know, a lot of people see the constables and they think that they don't have authority to arrest, or they can't do this, can't do that.
Yeah,
and a lot of constables don't. I didn't grab a constable, you know, while we went through training, and I would tell all the other constables, no, they're trying to tell you you could only collect funds for the, you know, money for the courts, but that's not it. You have more authority than that, you know, and I would question the instructor all the time on that, and he couldn't answer it.
Yeah.
Yeah, he could not answer. It's Title 44, Act 49, and that's where a lot of the, you know, the duties come from there, you know. But it is an executive branch, so I don't know how that plays into it. It's not
right.
a judicial position, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, John, good talking to you. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you very much for your information. All right. We're a little over time, but we have, who is this in the People's Lawman? I'm going to open it up because maybe we'll spend just a couple minutes because it sounds like this is more information on the subject at hand. What is it? Tzok Chil. I don't know. You've been open. Go ahead. People's Lawman at Gmail.
It's Chicago, Illinois.
Chicago, Illinois.
Right. So, just wanted to remind NLA members or whoever's listening that there's going to be a grassroots truther gathering this Wednesday, November 17th at 6:30 p.m. McConagall's Pub. Again, McConagall's Pub, 105 South Cook Street, Barrington, Illinois. So if you happen to be in the area or you want to meet some like-minded people, maybe speak about common law. I was invited to speak at that the event on Wednesday for common law. Two of the other speakers are going to talk about health and autonomy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's about it. Just wanted to squeeze that in.
Well, I appreciate it. It's good to see all the stuff that's happening now. And you know, this is the silver lining behind the cloud when you these types of things, as far as I can see. Because what it's doing is getting people interested in that type of stuff, you know.
Right. And one thing I will add that, you know, and I can appreciate how Cal Washington from the Empower Movement got stifled. And, of course, that's the enforcement, right?
Right.
And that's where I feel like we need to make that leap in terms of organized, lawful initiative with due notice, right? Let's go through that process. And I've drafted something, and it was a while ago when I was with a group within arm's reach, like Friends of the Children's Health Defense, where in the title it mentioned violence to kind of get attention, right? Like notice of violence. And I forget how I worded it because it was conditional, right? Like
right.
If they're going to, you know, threaten or actually take action, physical action to penetrate you, right, and inject you with some sort of venom or something, you know, then, hey, you have a right to defend yourself. And you can
absolutely
notice that will widen the eyes and be like, yeah, I mean it. It could be, you know, lethal defense that I can take. And guess what? It won't be just me. Look at all these hundreds or thousands or more people who feel the same and who might be outside your door with a common law warrant, you know, if there is such thing. But some sort of initiative, and I bring this up, I think, often when I call in about the spirit of, I think it was Joshua Glover, right, where thousands of people showed up over the weekend to bust him out of jail, right, during the abolitionist era, right, when slaves came to reclaim him, or slave owners, I should say. So somewhere we need to bridge this gap where we're actually taking lawful initiative, righteous lawful initiative.
And yeah, and I agree, especially when they're threatening to assault you. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's an unalienable right. It really is, and people gotta step up, basically, exactly. and maybe that's a good level to start it at. You know, it's about as grassroots as you can get, right?
Well, you know, I think the written word is where it lawfully starts, right? Then you go through the due notice process. And I think you might need, like, a group kind of initiative of being like, hey, are we willing to follow through on this, and how are we going to do that? And I think we need to really use the public domain to do this, so we're not hiding in the shadows.
Right.
We need to claim the public domain and let the roaches try to do their business in the shadows, because as our light grows, their domain will shrink to the mm-hmm. point where, I mean, they're already 7 or 8 decimal points to the, you know, to the right of zero in terms of percentage of people who control, right? The power, like, we are the 99.999%.
Right, right.
So we need to claim that public domain and force them to act lawfully, or we seize custody of the infrastructure that they've provided, right? Like, that they've been the beneficiaries of, you know, over centuries or millennia. Mm-hmm. We need to reclaim that, these industries, and seize the reins of whatever it is. You know,
well, that's what the Constitution says. When it becomes destructive, it's up to us to change it, right?
Right, and we don't need a piece of paper to tell us that. But
no, exactly. But it is what we're sort of inaugurated under. People have to step up, and, you know, it is just a piece of paper until you pick it up and you act on it. You know what I mean?
Right.
You know, it's up to us to give it the life that it needs, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Right.
You know, and there is a certain power there in the written word, and I think that's one of the things that's very good about those notices of liability, because it brings it right to that person's doorstep, and it says you're liable for what you're doing, personally liable, you know?
Right.
That shakes them up. So, anyway, it's all good. Thank you. And,
thank you.
You know, keep putting your input in, because, you know, steel sharpens steel, and that's what this is about, you know?
Yes, sir. Maybe I'll see you at one of these events one of these days.
Yes, I wish I could make it out. Anyway, thank you for your input, and I think it's time to go. We're 12 minutes over. Good shows, people, you know. Lots of exciting things, and you know, pray that things work out with the country, because we're close to I don't know what, but hopefully turning back over to a legal, lawful, constitutional republic. Anyway, God bless everybody, and we'll see you next week, same time. Thank you.